Don't come bothering me when you tear out her bottom. Now, listen up. The river runs pretty straight from St. Louis down to Cairo before the Ohio comes in, but you gotta know it anyhow. This here stretch is called a graveyard from time to time, 'cause a lot of boats went down here. Some you can still see the chimneys peeping up above the water, or the whole damn wreck lying in the mud if the river's low. The ones that are down under the waterline, though, you better know where they lie, or the next damn boat coming down is going to have to know where you lie. You got to learn your marks, too, and how to handle the boat. Here, step on up and take the wheel. Get the feel of her. You couldn't touch bottom with a church steeple right now. It's safe enough. York and Fram changed places. Now, the first point below St. Louis, Fram began. Abner Marsh sat himself down on the couch listening, while the pilot went on and on, meandering from the marks to tricks of steering to long stories about the steamers that lay sunken in the graveyard they were running. He was a colorful storyteller, but after every tale he'd recollect the task at hand and meander back to the marks again. York drank it all in, quiet-like. He seemed to pick up the knack of steering quickly, and whenever Fram stopped and asked him to repeat some bit of information, Joshua just reeled it back at him. At length, after they'd caught and passed the side-wheeler that had been running ahead of them, Marsh found himself yawning. It was such a fine, sharp night, though, that he hated to go to bed. He hoisted himself up and went down to the Texas tender, coming back with a pot of hot coffee and a plate of tarts. When he returned, Carl Fram was spinning the yarn about the wreck of the Drennan White, lost above Natchez in 50, with a treasure aboard her. The Evermond tried to raise her, caught fire, and went to the bottom. The Ellen Adams, a salvage steamer, came looking for the treasure in 51, struck a bar and half sank. "The treasure's cursed, you see," Fram was saying. "Either that or that old devil river just don't want to give it up." Marsh smiled and poured the coffee. "Joshua," he said, "that story's true enough, but don't you go believing everything he says. This man's the most notorious liar on the river." "Why, Captain," Fram said, grinning. He turned back to the river. "See that old cabin yonder, with the tumbly-down porch?" he said. "Good, 'cause you got to recollect it." And he was off again. It was a solid 20 minutes before he got distracted by the story of E. Jenkins, the steamer that was 30 miles long with hinges in the middle so it could make the turns in the river. Even Joshua York gave Fram an incredulous look for that one, but he was smiling. Marsh retired about an hour after he'd eaten the last of the tarts. Fram was amusing enough, but he'd take his lessons by day when he could damn well see the marks the pilot was talking about. When he woke, it was morning, and the fever dream was at Cape Girardeau, taking on a load of grist. Fram had elected to put in there sometime during the night, he learned, when some fog closed in around them. Cape Girardeau was a haughty town perched up on its bluffs, some 150 miles below St. Louis, and Marsh did some figuring and was pleased with their time. It was no record, but it was good. Within the hour, the fever dream was back on the river, heading downstream. The July sun was fierce overhead, the air thick with heat and humidity and insects, but up on the Texas deck it was cool and serene. Stops were frequent. With 18 big boilers to keep hot, the steamer ate wood like nobody's business, but fuel was never a problem. Woodyards dotted both banks regularly. Whenever they got low, the mate would signal up to the pilot, and they'd put in near some ramshackle little cabin surrounded by big stacks of split beech or oak or chestnut, and Marsh or Jonathan Jeffers would go ashore and dicker with the woodyard men. When they gave the signal, the deckhands would swarm ashore at those cords of wood, and in three blinks of your eye it would be gone, stowed aboard the steamer. Cabin passengers always liked to watch the wooding operations from the railings on the boiler deck. Deck passengers always liked to get in the way. They stopped at all manner of towns as well, causing no end of excitement. They stopped at an unmarked landing to discharge one passenger and a private dock to pick one up. Around noon, they stopped for a woman and child who hailed them from a bank, and close to 4, they had to slow and back their wheels so 3 men in a rowboat could catch them and clamber aboard. The fever dream didn't run far that day, or fast. By the time the westering sun was turning the broad waters a deep burnished red, they were in sight of Cairo, and Dan Albright chose to tie up there for the night. South of Cairo, the Ohio flowed into the Mississippi, and the two rivers made an odd sight. They wouldn't merge all at once, but kept each to itself. The clear blue flow of the Ohio, a bright ribbon down the eastern bank, against the murkier brown waters of the Mississippi. Here, too, was where the lower river took on its own peculiar character. From Cairo to New Orleans and the Gulf, a distance of nearly 1,100 miles, the Mississippi coiled and looped and bent round and about like a writhing snake, changing its course at the merest whim, eating through the soft soil unpredictably, sometimes leaving docks high and dry, or putting whole towns under water. The pilots claimed the river was never the same twice. The upper Mississippi, where Abner Marsh had been born and had learned his trade, was an entirely different place, confined between high, rocky bluffs and running straight as often as not. Marsh stood up on the hurricane deck for a long time, looking at the passing scenery and trying to feel the difference of it, and the difference it would make to his future. He had crossed from the upper river to the lower, he thought, and into a new part of his life. Shortly after, Marsh was joined with Jeffers in the clerk's office when he heard the bell sound three times, the signal for a landing. He frowned and looked out Jeffers' window. Nothing was visible except densely wooded banks. "I wonder why we're landing," Marsh said. "New Madrid, the next stop. I may not know this part of the river, but this sure ain't New Madrid." Jeffers shrugged. "Perhaps we were hailed." Marsh begged his pardon and went on up to the pilot house. Dan Albright was at the wheel. "Was there a hail?" Marsh asked. "No, sir," answered Albright. He was a laconic sort. He answered what you asked him, barely. "Where are we stopping?" "Woodyard, Captain." Marsh saw there was indeed a woodyard up ahead, on the west bank. "Mr. Albright, I do believe we wooded up not an hour ago. We can't have burned it all already. Did Harry Mike ask you to land?" The mate was supposed to keep track of when a steamer needed wood. "No, sir. This is Captain York's order. The word was passed along that I was to put in at this particular woodyard, whether we wanted wood or not." Albright glanced over. He was a trim little fellow with a thin dark mustache, a red silk tie, and patent leather boots. "Are you telling me to pass by?" "No," Abner Marsh said hastily. York might have warned him, he thought, but their bargain gave Joshua the right to give queer orders. "You know how long we're going to be here?" "I hear York has business ashore. If he don't get up till dark, that's all day." "Damn. Our schedule. The passengers will be asking no end of bothersome questions." Marsh frowned. "Well, I suppose there's no help for it. We might as well take on some more wood, long as we're here. I'll go see to it." Marsh struck up a bargain with the boy running the woodyard, a slender Negro in a thin cotton shirt. The boy wasn't much for dickering. Marsh got beech from him at cottonwood prices and made him throw in some pine knots, too. As the roustabouts and deckhands meandered over to load up, Marsh looked the colored boy square in the eye, smiled, and said, "You're new at this, ain't you?" The boy nodded. "Yes, sir, Captain." Marsh nodded and was starting to turn back to the steamer, but the boy continued, "I just been here a week, Captain. Old white man used to be here, got himself fed up by wolves." Marsh looked at the boy hard. "We're only a couple of miles north of New Madrid, ain't we, boy?" "That's right, Captain." When Abner Marsh returned to the fever dream, he was feeling very agitated. Damn Joshua York, he thought. What was the man up to, and why did they have to waste a whole day at this fool woodyard? Marsh had a good mind to go storming up to York's cabin and give him a good talking to. He considered the idea briefly, then thought better of it. It was none of his business, Marsh reminded himself forcibly. He settled down to wait. The hours passed slowly as the fever dream lay dead in the water off the woodyard. A dozen other steamers slid by downriver, much to Abner Marsh's annoyance. Almost as many came struggling upstream. A brief knife fight between two deck passengers, in which no one was injured, provided the afternoon's excitement. Mostly, the passengers and crew of the Fever Dream lazed about on her decks, chairs tilted back in the sun, smoking or chewing or arguing politics. Jeffers and Albright played chess in the pilot house. Fram told wild stories in the Grand Saloon. Some of the ladies started talk of getting up a dance, and Abner Marsh grew more and more impatient. At dark, Marsh was sitting up on the Texas porch, drinking coffee and swatting mosquitoes, when he happened to glance toward shore in time to see Joshua York leave the steamer. Simon was with him. They stopped by the cabin and talked briefly to the woodyard boy, then vanished down a rutted mud road into the woods. "Well, I'll be," Marsh said, rising. "But not even a by your leave or a hello." He frowned. "No supper, neither." That reminded him, though, and he went on down to the main cabin to eat. The night went by. Passengers and crew alike grew restless. Drinking was heavy around the bar. Some planters started up a game of brag, and others began to sing. And one stiff-necked young man got himself hit with a cane for calling for abolition. Near midnight, Simon returned alone. Abner Marsh was in the saloon when Harry Mike tapped him on the shoulder. Marsh had left orders to be summoned as soon as York came back. "Get your rosters aboard and tell Whitey to get our steam up," he snapped at the mate. "We got us some time to make up." Then he went to see York. Only York wasn't there. "Joshua wants you to go on," Simon reported. "He will travel by land and meet you in New Madrid. Wait for him." Heated questioning drew nothing more out of him. Simon only fixed Marsh with his small, cold eyes and repeated the message, that the Fever Dream was to wait for York at New Madrid. Once steam was up, it was a short, pleasant voyage. New Madrid was a bare few miles downriver from the woodyard where they had been tied up all day. Marsh gladly bid the desolate place farewell as they steamed off into the night. "Damn that Joshua," he muttered. They lost almost 2 full days in New Madrid. "He's dead," Jonathan Jeffers opined when they had been tied up for a day and a half. New Madrid had hotels, billiard parlors, churches, and diverse other recreations not available in woodyards, so the time spent at the landing was not near as boring, but nonetheless everyone was anxious to be off. A half dozen passengers, impatient with the delay when the weather was good, the boat seemed in fine fettle and the stage was high, came up to Marsh and demanded a refund of their passage money. They were indignantly refused, but Marsh still seethed and wondered aloud where Joshua York had got himself to. "York ain't dead," Marsh said. "I'm not saying he ain't going to wish he was dead when I get a hold of him, but he ain't dead yet." Behind the gold spectacles, Jeffers' eyebrow arched. "No? How can you be so sure, Captain? He was alone, on foot, going through the woods by night. There are scoundrels out there. And animals, too. I do believe there have been a number of deaths around New Madrid the last few years." Marsh stared at him. "What's that?" he demanded. "How do you know?" "I read the papers," said Jeffers. Marsh scowled. "Well, it don't make no difference. York ain't dead. I know that, Mr. Jeffers. I know that for a fact." "Lost, then?" suggested the clerk with a cool smile. "Shall we get up a party and go look for him, Captain?" "I'll think on that," said Abner Marsh. But there was no need. That night, an hour after the sun had set, Joshua York came striding up to the landing. He did not look like a man who had spent 2 days off by himself in the woods. His boots and trouser legs were dusty, but other than that, his clothing looked as elegant as on the night he had left. His gait was rushed, but graceful. He bounded up the stage and smiled when he saw Jack Eli, the second engineer. "Find Whitey and get the steam up," York said to Eli. "We're leaving." Then, before anyone could question him, he was halfway up the grand staircase. Marsh, for all his anger and restlessness, found himself remarkably relieved at Joshua's return. "Go ring the goddamn bell so them that went ashore know we're leaving," he told Harry Mike. "I want to get us out on the river again, soon as we can." York was in his cabin, washing his hands in the basin of water that sat atop his chest of drawers. "Abner?" he said politely when Marsh came rushing in after a brief, thunderous knock. "Do you think I might trouble Toby for a late supper?" "I'll trouble you to ask why we've been wasting all this time," Marsh said. "Damn it, Joshua, I know you said you'd act queer, but 2 days. Ain't no way to run a steam packet, I tell you that." York dried his long, pale hands carefully and turned. "It was important. I warn you that I may do it again. You will have to accustom yourself to my ways, Abner, and see that I am not questioned. We got freight to deliver, and passengers who paid for passage, not for lounging around at woodyards. What do I tell them, Joshua?" "Whatever you choose. You are ingenious, Abner. I provided the money in our partnership. I expect you to provide the excuses." His tone was cordial but firm. "If it is any solace, this first trip will be the worst. On future trips, I anticipate few, if any, mysterious excursions. You'll get your record run without any trouble from me." He smiled. "I hope you can be satisfied with that. Take hold of your impatience, friend. We'll reach New Orleans eventually, and then things will go easier. Can you accept that, Abner?" "Abner? Is anything wrong?" Abner Marsh had been squinting hard and scarcely listening to York at all. He must have had an odd look on his face, he realized. "No," he said quickly. "Just 2 days, that's all that's wrong. But it's no matter, no matter at all. Whatever you say, Joshua." York nodded, seemingly satisfied. "I am going to change and bother Toby for a meal, and then go on up to the pilot house to learn more of your river. Who has the afterwatch tonight?"
"Mr. Fram," said Marsh.
"Good," York said. "Carl is very entertaining."
"That he is," replied Marsh.
"Excuse me, Joshua. Got to get down below and see to things, if we're going to get underway tonight." He turned abruptly and left the cabin. But outside, in the heat of the night, Abner Marsh leaned heavily on his walking stick and stared off into the star-flecked darkness, trying to summon up the thing he thought he'd seen across the cabin. If only his eyes were better. If only York had lit both oil lamps instead of just one. If only he had dared to walk closer. It had been hard to make out, all the way over there on the chest of drawers, but Marsh couldn't get it out of his mind. The cloth on which York had been wiping his hands had stains on it. Dark stains. Reddish. And they'd look too damn much like blood. Chapter 9. Aboard the steamer Fever Dream, Mississippi River, August 1857. Day after tedious day slipped by as the Fever Dream crept down the Mississippi. A fleet steamer could run from St. Louis to New Orleans and back in 28 days or so, even allowing for intermediate stops and landings. For a week or more at wharfside loading or unloading, and for a reasonable amount of bad weather. But at the pace the Fever Dream was keeping, it was going to take them a month just to reach New Orleans. It seemed to Abner Marsh as if the weather, the river, and Joshua York were all conspiring to slow him down. Fog lay over the water for 2 days, thick and gray as soiled cotton. Dan Albright ran through it for some 6 hours, cautiously steering the steamer into solid, shifting walls of mist that faded and gave way before her, leaving Marsh a mass of nerves. Had it been up to him, they would have laid up the moment the fog closed in, rather than risk the Fever Dream. But out on the river, it was the pilot who decided such things, not the captain, and Albright pressed on. Finally, though, the mists grew too thick even for him, and they lost a day and a half at a landing near Memphis, watching the brown water rush past and tug at them, and listening to distant splashes in the fog. Once a raft came by, a fire burning on its deck, and they heard the raftsmen calling out to them, vague, faint cries that echoed over the river before the gray swallowed raft and sound boat. When the fog had finally lifted enough so that Carl Fram judged it safe to try the river again, they steamed for less than an hour before coming up hard on a bar as Fram tried to run an uncertain cutoff and save some time. Deckhands and firemen and roustabouts spilled ashore, with Harry Mike supervising, and walked the steamer over, but it took more than 3 hours, and afterward they crept along slow, with Albright out ahead in the yawl taking soundings. Finally, they got clear of the cutoff and into good water again, but that was not the end of their troubles. There was a thunderstorm 3 days later, and more than once the Fever Dream had to take the long way around a bend in the river because of snags or low water in the chutes or cutoffs, or move along slow, paddles barely turning, while the sounding yawl edged out ahead with the off-duty pilot and an officer and a picked crew to drop lead and call back the news. "Quarter twain," or "quarter less three," or "mark three." The nights were black and overcast when they weren't foggy. If the steamer ran at all, she ran carefully, at quarter speed or less, with no smoking allowed up in the pilot house, and all the windows below carefully curtained and shuttered so that the boat gave off no light and the steersman could more easily see the river. The banks were pitch and desolate those nights, and moved around like restless corpses, shifting here and there so a man couldn't easily make out where the deep water ran, or even where water ended and land began. The river ran dark as sin, with no moonlight or stars upon it. Some nights it was hard even to spy the Nighthawk, the device partway up the flagpole by which pilots gauged their marks. But Fram and Albright, different as they were both lightning pilots, and they kept the Fever Dream moving when it was possible to move at all. The times when they tied up were times when nothing moved on the river except rafts and logs, and a handful of flatboats and small steamers that didn't hardly draw nothing at all. Joshua York helped them along. Each night he was up in the pilot house to stand his watch like a proper cub. "I told him right off that a night like that weren't no good," Fram said to Marsh once over dinner. "I couldn't learn him, Mark, that I couldn't rightly see myself, could I? Well, that man's got the damnedest eyes for the darkness I ever seen. There's times I swear he's seeing right into the water, and it ain't nothing to him how black it gets. I keep him by me and tell him the marks, and 9 times out of 10 he sees them before I do. Last night I think I would have tied her up halfway through the dog watch but for Joshua." But York delayed the steamer as well. 6 additional landings were made on his order, at Greenville, and at 2 smaller towns, and at a private wharf in Tennessee, and twice at Woodyard's. Twice he was gone all night. At Memphis, York had no business ashore, but elsewhere he dragged out their layovers intolerably. When they put in at Helena, he was gone overnight, and at Napoleon he held them up 3 days, him and Simon, doing God knows what off by themselves. Vicksburg was even worse. There they idled 4 nights away before Joshua York finally returned to the Fever Dream. The day they steamed out of Memphis, the sunset was especially pretty. A few lingering wisps of mist took on an orange glow, and the clouds in the west turned a vivid fiery red until the sky itself seemed aflame. But Abner Marsh, standing alone up on the Texas deck, had eyes only for the river. No other steamers were in sight. The water ahead of them was calm. Here the wind sent up a series of ripples, and there the current flowed around the wicked black limbs of a fallen tree jutting out from the shore, but mostly the old devil was placid, and as the sun went down, the muddy water took on a reddish tinge, a tinge that grew and spread and darkened until it seemed as if the Fever Dream moved upon a flowing river of blood. Then the sun vanished behind the trees, and the clouds, and slowly the blood darkened, going brown as blood does when it dries, and finally black, dead black, black as the grave. Marsh watched the last crimson eddies vanish. No stars came out that night. He went down to supper with blood on his mind. Days had passed since New Madrid, and Abner Marsh had done nothing, said nothing, but he had done a considerable amount of thinking about what he had seen, or what he hadn't seen, in Joshua's cabin. He couldn't be sure he had seen anything, of course. Besides, what if he had? Perhaps Joshua had cut himself in the woods. Though Marsh had looked closely at York's hands the following night and had seen no signs of a cut or scab, perhaps he had butchered an animal, or defended himself against thieves. A dozen good reasons presented themselves, but all fell before the simple fact of Joshua's silence. If York had nothing to hide, why was he so damn secretive? The more Abner Marsh thought on that, the less he liked it. Marsh had seen blood before, plenty of it. Fist fights and canings, duels and shootings. The river ran down into slave country, and blood flowed easily there for those whose skin was black. The free states weren't much better. Marsh had been in Bleeding Kansas for a time, and seen men burned and shot. He had served in the Illinois militia when he was younger, and had fought in the Black Hawk War. He still dreamt at times of the Battle of Bad Axe, when they cut down Black Hawk's people, women and children too, as they tried to cross the Mississippi to the safety of the western shore. That had been a bloody day, but needed. Black Hawk had come a-warring and a-raiding over to Illinois, after all. The blood that might or might not have been on Joshua's hands was different somehow. It left Marsh uneasy, disquieted. Still, he reminded himself, he had made a bargain. A bargain was a bargain to Abner Marsh, and a man was bound to keep those he made, whether good or bad, whether with a preacher or a sharper or the devil himself. Joshua York had mentioned having enemies, Marsh recalled, and a man's dealing with his enemies were his own business. York had been fair enough with Marsh. So he reasoned and tried to put the whole matter from his mind. But the Mississippi turned to blood, and there was bleeding in his dreams as well. Aboard the fever dream, the mood began to grow bored and somber. A striker got careless and was scalded by the steam and had to be set ashore at Napoleon. A roustabout ran off at Vicksburg, which was crazy, it being slave country and him a free colored man. Fights broke out among the deck passengers. It was the boredom and the thick, suffocating, wet heat of August, Jeffers told himself. Trash gets crazy when it gets hot, Harry Mike echoed. Abner Marsh wasn't so sure. It seemed almost like they were being punished. Missouri and Tennessee vanished behind them, and Marsh fretted. Cities and towns and woodyards drifted by. Days turned into torturously slow weeks, and they lost passengers and cargo because of York's layovers. Marsh went ashore and to saloons and hotels popular with steamboatmen and listened, and didn't like the gab he heard about his boat. For all her boilers, one story ran, the Fever Dream was built too big and heavy and wasn't very fast at all. Engine trouble, another rumor claimed. Seams near to bursting on the boilers. That was bad talk. Boiler explosions were greatly feared. A mate from some New Orleans boat told Marsh in Vicksburg that the Fever Dream looked sweet enough, but her captain was just some no-count upper river man who didn't have the courage to run her full out. Marsh nearly broke open his head. There was talk about York as well, him and his queer friends and their ways. The Fever Dream was starting to get herself a reputation, sure enough, but it was not one that Abner Marsh was over-partial to. By the time they came steaming into Natchez, Marsh had had quite enough. It was an hour shy of dusk when they first sighted Natchez in the distance, a few lights burning already in the ruddy afternoon, shadows lengthening from the west. It had been a fine day, but for the heat. They'd made their best time since leaving Cairo. The river had a golden sheen to it, and the sun shimmered upon it like a burnished brass ornament, gaudy as all get-out, rippling and dancing when the wind breathed upon the water. Marsh had taken to bed that afternoon, feeling a bit under the weather, but he got himself out of the cabin when he heard the whistle shriek in answer to the call of another steamer that came high and sweet over the water. They were talking to each other, Marsh knew, an ascending and a descending boat deciding which would pass to the right and which to the left when they met. It happened a dozen times each day, but there was something in the voice of the other boat that called to him, dragged him from his sweaty sheets, and he came out of the Texas just in time to see her pass. The eclipse, swift and haughty, the gilded device between her chimneys glittering in the sun, her passengers thick on her decks, smoke rolling and tumbling from her. Marsh watched her recede upriver until only her smoke could be seen, a strange tightness in his gut all the while. When the eclipse had faded like a dream fades in the morning, Marsh turned, and there was Natchez up ahead of them. He heard the bells sounding the signal for a landing, and their whistle called again. A tangle of steamers crowded the landing, and beyond them two cities waited for the Fever Dream. Up on its lofty, precipitous bluffs was Natchez on a Hill, the proper city, with its broad streets, its trees and flowers, and all its grand houses. Each one had a name. Monmouth, Linden, Auburn, Ravenna, Concord and Belfast and Windy Hill, the Burn. Marsh had been in Natchez a half dozen times in his younger days, before he'd had steamers of his own, and he had made it a point to go walking up there and see all those storied houses. They were goddamn palaces, every one of them, and Marsh didn't feel quite comfortable there. The old families who lived inside them acted like kings, too, aloof and arrogant, drinking their mint juleps and their sherry cobblers, icing their damned wine, amusing themselves by racing their high-bred horses and hunting bears, dueling with revolvers and bowie knives over the slightest trifling affront. The Nabobs, Marsh had heard them called. They were a fine lot, and every goddamned one of them seemed to be a colonel. Sometimes they showed up on the landing, and then you had to invite them aboard your steamboat for cigars and drinks, no matter how they behaved. But they were a curiously blind bunch. From their great houses on the bluffs, the Nabobs looked out over the shining majesty of the river, but somehow they couldn't see the things that were right underneath them. For beneath the mansions, between the river and the bluffs, was another city, Natchez under the hill. No marble column stood there, and there were precious few flowers either. The streets were mud and dust. Brothels clustered round the steamer landing and lined Silver Street, or what was left of it. Much of the street had caved into the river 20 years ago, and the walks that remained were half-sunken and lined with tawdry women and dangerous, cold-eyed, foppish young men. Main Street was all saloons and billiard rooms and gambling halls, and each night the city below the city steamed and seethed. Brawls and brags and blood, crooked poker and Spanish burials, whores who'd do most anything, and men who'd grin at you and take your purse and slit your throat in the bargain. That was Natchez under the hill. Whiskey and flesh and cards, red lights and raucous song and watered gin. That was the way of it by the river. Steamboatmen loved and hated Natchez under the hill, and its milling population of cheap women and cutthroats and gamblers and free blacks and mulattoes, even though the older men swore that the city under the bluffs today wasn't nothing near as wild as it had been 40 years back, or even before the tornado that God had sent to clean it out in 1840. Marsh didn't know about that. It was wild enough for him, and he'd spent several memorable nights there years ago, but this time he had a bad feeling about it. Briefly, Marsh entertained a notion to pass it by, to climb on up to the pilot house and tell Albright to keep on going. But they had passengers to land, freight to unload, and the crew would be looking forward to a night in fabled Natchez. So Marsh did nothing for all his misgivings. The Fever Dream steamed in, and was made fast for the night. They quieted her down, damped her steam, and let the fires die in her guts. And then her crew spilled from her like blood from an open wound. A few of them paused on the landing to buy frozen creams or fruit from the black peddlers with their carts, but most streamed right down Silver Street toward the hot, bright lights. Abner Marsh lingered on the Texas porch until the stars began to peer out. Song came drifting over the water from the windows of the brothels, but it did not lighten his mood. At last, Joshua York opened his cabin door and stepped out into the night. "You going ashore, Joshua?" Marsh asked him. York smiled coolly. "Yes, Abner." "How long will you be gone this time?" Joshua York gave an elegant shrug. "I cannot say. I will return as soon as I can. Wait for me." "I'd sooner go with you, Joshua," Marsh said. "That's Natchez out there. Natchez under the hill. It's a rough place. We might be waiting here a month while you lay in some gutter with your throat cut. Let me come with you, show you around. I'm a riverman, you ain't." "No," York said. "I have business ashore, Abner." "We're partners, ain't we? Your business is my business, where the Fever Dream is concerned." I have concerns beyond our steamboat, friend. Some things you cannot help me with. Some things I must do alone. Simon goes with you, don't he? At times. That is different, Abner. Simon and I share certain interests that you and I do not. You mentioned enemies once, Joshua. If that's what you're talking, taking care of those who wronged you, then tell me. I'll help. Joshua York shook his head. No, Abner. My enemies might not be your enemies. Let me decide that, Joshua. You've been fair with me so far. Trust me to be fair with you. I cannot, York replied sorrowfully. Abner, we have a bargain. Ask me no questions, please. Now, if you would, let me pass. Abner Marsh nodded and moved aside, and Joshua York swept by him and started down the stairs. Joshua! Marsh called out when York was almost to the bottom. The other turned. Be careful, Joshua, Marsh said. Natchez can be bloody. York stared up at him for a long time, his eyes as gray and unreadable as smoke. Yes, he said finally. I will take care. Then he turned and was gone. Abner Marsh watched him go ashore and vanish into Natchez under the hill, his lean figure throwing long shadows beneath the smoking lamps. When Joshua York was quite gone, Marsh turned and proceeded forward to the captain's cabin. The door was locked, as he had known it would be. Marsh reached in his ample pocket and came out with the key. He hesitated before putting it in the lock. Having duplicate keys made and stored in the steamer's safe, that was no betrayal, just plain sense. People died in locked cabins, after all, and it was better to have a spare key than to have to break the door in. But using the key, that was something else. He had made a bargain, after all. But partners had to trust each other, and if Joshua York would not trust him, how could he expect trust in return? Resolute, Marsh opened the lock and entered York's cabin. Inside, he lit an oil lamp and locked the door behind him. He stood there uncertainly for a moment, looking around, wondering what he hoped to find. York's cabin was just a big stateroom, looking like it had all the other times Marsh had visited it. Still, there must be something here that would tell him something about York, give him some clue as to the nature of his partner's peculiarities. Marsh moved to the desk, which seemed the most likely place to begin, carefully eased himself into York's chair, and began to sift through the newspapers. He touched them gingerly, noting the position of each paper as he slid it out for examination, so that he could leave all as he found it when he left. The newspapers were, well, newspapers. There must have been 50 of them on the desk, numbers old and new, the Herald and the Tribune from New York, several Chicago papers, all the St. Louis and New Orleans journals, papers from Napoleon and Baton Rouge, and Memphis and Greenville, and Vicksburg and Bayou Sara, weeklies from a dozen little river towns. Most of them were intact. A few had stories cut from them. Beneath the litter of newspapers, Marsh found two leather-bound ledger books. He eased them out slowly, trying to ignore a nervous clenching in his stomach. Perhaps here he had a journal or a diary, Marsh thought, something to tell him where York had come from and where he aimed to go. He opened the first ledger and frowned in disappointment. No diary. Only stories, carefully cut from newspapers and mounted with paste, each one labeled as to date and place in Joshua's flowing hand. Marsh read the story before him, from a Vicksburg paper, about a body that had been found washed up on the riverfront. The date placed it 6 months back. On the opposite page were two items, both from Vicksburg as well. A family found dead in a shanty 20 miles from the city. A Negro wench, probably a runaway, discovered stiff in the woods, dead of unknown causes. Marsh turned the pages, read, turned again. After a time he closed the book and opened the other. It was the same. Page after page of bodies, mysterious deaths, corpses discovered here and there. all arranged by city. Marsh closed the books and returned them to their place and tried to consider. The newspapers had lots of accounts of deaths and killings that York hadn't bothered to cut out. Why? He searched through a few newspapers and read over them until he was sure. Then Marsh frowned. It appeared that Joshua had no interest in shootings or knifings, in rivermen drowned or blown up by boiler explosions or burned, and gamblers and thieves hanged by the law. The stories he collected were different. Deaths no one could account for. Folks with throats tore out. Bodies all mutilated and ripped up, or else too far rotted for anyone to know just how they'd died. Bodies unmarked as well. Found dead for no reason anyone could find. Found with wounds too small to notice at first. Found whole but bloodless. Between the two ledgers, there must have been 50 or 60 stories, 9 months' worth of deaths drawn from the whole length of the lower Mississippi. Briefly, Abner Marsh was afraid, sick at heart at the thought that perhaps Joshua was saving accounts of his own vile deeds. But a moment's thought proved that could not be. Some, perhaps. But in other cases, the dates were wrong. Joshua had been with him in St. Louis, or New Albany, or aboard the Fever Dream when these people met their ghastly ends. He could not be responsible. Still, Marsh saw, there was a pattern to the stops York had ordered, to his secretive trips ashore. He was visiting the sites of these stories one by one. What was York looking for? What? Or who? An enemy? An enemy who had done all this, somehow, moving up and down the river? If so, then Joshua was on the side of right. But why the silence, if his purpose was just? It had to be more than one enemy, Marsh realized. No single person could be responsible for all the killing in those ledgers, and Joshua had said, enemies, after all. Besides, he had come back from New Madrid with blood on his hands, but that did not end his quest. He could not make sense of it. Marsh began to go through the drawers and storage nooks in York's desk. Paper, fancy stationery, impressed with a picture of the Fever Dream and the name of the line. Envelopes, ink, a half-dozen pens, a blotter, a map of the river system with marks on it, boot polish, sealing wax. In short, nothing useful. In one drawer he found letters, and turned to them hopefully. But they told him nothing. Two were letters of credit, the rest simple business correspondence, with agents in London, New York, St. Louis, and other cities. Marsh did come on one letter from a banker in St. Louis, bringing Fever River packets to York's attention. "I think it best suited to your purposes, as you described them," the man had written. "Its owner is an experienced riverman with a reputation for honesty, said to be exceedingly ugly, but fair. And he has recently had reverses, which should make him receptive to your offer." The letter went on, but told Marsh nothing he had not already known. Replacing the letters as he had found them, Abner Marsh rose and moved about the cabin, looking for something else, something to enlighten him. He found nothing. Clothing in the drawers, York's vile-tasting drink in the wine rack, suits hung in the closet, books everywhere. Marsh checked the titles of the volumes by York's bedside. One was a book of poetry by Shelley, the other some sort of medical book he could scarcely understand a line of. The tall bookcase offered more of the same, much fiction and poetry, a fair amount of history, books on medicine and philosophy and natural science, a dusty old tome on alchemy, an entire shelf of books in foreign languages. A few untitled books, hand-bound and finely tooled leather with gold-leaf pages, presented themselves, and Marsh pulled one out, hoping this might be the diary or log to answer his questions. But if it was, he could not read it. The words were in some grotesque, spindly code, and the hand was clearly not Joshua's airy script, but rather crabbed and tiny. Marsh went through the cabin one final time to make sure he had overlooked nothing, and finally determined to leave, not much wiser than he had come. He inserted the key in the lock, turned it carefully, snuffed the lamp, stepped outside, and relocked the door behind him. It had gotten a trifle cooler outside. Marsh realized that he was drenched in sweat. He slipped the key back into his coat pocket and turned to go, and stopped. A few yards away, the ghastly old woman Catherine was standing and staring at him, cold malevolence in her eyes. Marsh decided to brazen it out. He tipped his cap. "Good evening, ma'am," he said to her. Catherine smiled slowly, a creeping rictus of a smile that twisted her vulpine face into a mask of terrible glee. "Good evening, Captain," he said. Her teeth, Marsh noted, were yellow and very long. Chapter 10. New Orleans, August 1857. After Adrienne and Elaine had departed on the steamer Cotton Queen, bound for Baton Rouge and Bayou Sara, Damon Julien decided to take a stroll along the levee to a French coffee stall he knew. Sour Billy Tipton walked uneasily beside him, casting suspicious glances at everyone they passed. The rest of Julian's party followed. Kurt and Cynthia walked together, while Armand brought up the rear, furtive and ill at ease, already touched by the thirst. Michelle was back at the house. The rest were gone, dispersed, sent up or down the river on one steamer or another by Julian's command, searching for money, safety, a new place to gather. Damon Julien had finally stirred. The moonlight was soft and bright as butter upon the river. The stars were out. Along the levee, dozens of steamers crowded in next to the sailing ships with their high, proud masts and furled canvas sails. Niggers moved cotton and sugar and flour from one sort of boat to the other. The air was humid and fragrant, the streets crowded. They found a table that gave them a good view of the bustle, and ordered café au lait and the fried sugar pastries the stall was famous for. Sour Billy bit into one and got sugar powder all over his vest and sleeves. He cussed loudly. Damon Julien laughed, his laughter as sweet as the moonlight. "Ah, Billy, how amusing you are." Sour Billy hated being laughed at, worse than he hated anything, but he looked up at Julian's dark eyes and forced a grin. "Yes, sir," he said with a rueful shake of his head. Julian ate his own pastry neatly, so no sugar whitened the rich dark gray of his suit or the sheen of his scarlet tie. When he was done, he sipped at his café au lait while his gaze swept over the levee and wandered among the passers-by on the street. "There," he said shortly, "the woman beneath the cypress." The others looked. "Is she not striking?" She was a Creole lady, escorted by two dangerous-looking gentlemen. Damon Julien stared at her like a love-struck youth, his pale face unlined and serene, his hair a mass of fine dark curls, his eyes large and melancholy. But even across the table, Sour Billy could feel the heat in those eyes, and he was afraid. "She is exquisite," Cynthia said. "She has Valerie's hair," Armand added. Kurt smiled. "Will you take her, Damon?" The woman and her companions were going away from them, walking in front of an ornate wrought iron fence. Damon Julien watched them thoughtfully. "No," he said at last, turning back to the table and sipping his café au lait. "The night is too young, the streets are too crowded, and I am weary. Let us sit." Armand looked downcast and anxious. Julien smiled at him briefly, then leaned forward and laid a hand on Armand's sleeve. "We will drink before the dawn comes," he said. "You have my word." "I know a place," Sour Billy added conspiratorially. "A real fancy house with a bar, red velvet chairs, good drinks. The girls are all beautiful, you'll see. You can get one all night for a $20 gold piece. In the morning, well, well," he chuckled. "But we'll be gone when they find what they find. And it's cheaper than buying fancy girls, yes, sir." Damon Julian's black eyes were amused. "Billy makes me niggardly," he said to the others. "But whatever would we do without him?" He looked about again, bored. "I should come into the city more often. When one is sated, one loses sight of all the other pleasures." He sighed. "Can you feel it? The air is rank with it, Billy." What? Said Sour Billy.
Life, Billy.
Julian's smile mocked him, but Billy made himself smile back. Life and love and lust. Rich food and rich wine. Rich dreams and hope, Billy. All of it here around us. Possibilities. His eyes glittered. Why should I pursue that beauty who went by us, when there are so many others, so many possibilities? Can you answer? Mr. Julian, I don't...
No, Billy, you don't, do you?
Julian laughed. My whims are life and death to these cattle, Billy. If you are ever to be one of us, you must understand that. I am pleasure, Billy. I am power. And the essence of what I am, of pleasure and power, lies in possibility. My own possibilities are vast and have no limit, as our years have no limit. But I am the limit to these cattle. I am the end of all their hopes, of all their possibilities. Do you begin to understand? To slake the red thirst, that is nothing. Any old darky on his deathbed will do for that. Yet how much finer to drink of the young, the rich, the beautiful, those whose lives stretch out ahead of them, whose days and nights glitter and shine with promise. Blood is but blood. Any animal can sip at it. Any of them. He gestured languidly at the steamboatmen on the levee, the niggers toting their hogsheads, and all the richly dressed folk of the Vieux Carré. It is not the blood that ennobles, that makes one a master. It is the life, Billy. Drink of their lives, and yours becomes longer. Eat of their flesh, and yours grows stronger. Feast on beauty, and wax more beautiful. Sour Billy Tipton listened eagerly. He had seldom seen Julian in so expansive a mood. Sitting in the darkness of the library, Julian tended to be brusque and frightening. Beyond it, out in the world again, he glittered, reminding Sour Billy of the way he had been when he first arrived with Charles Garou at the plantation where Billy was overseer. He said as much. Julian nodded. Yes, he said. The plantation is safe, but in safety and satiety is danger. His teeth were white when he smiled. Charles Garou, he mused. Ah, the possibilities of that youth. He was beautiful in his way, strong, healthy, a firebrand, beloved by all the ladies, admired by other men. Even the darkies loved Master Charles. He would have had a grand life. His nature was so open as well. It was easy to befriend him, to win his undying trust by saving him from poor Kurt here. Julian interrupted himself with a laugh. Then, once I had been welcomed into his house, easier still to come to him every night and drain him little by little, so he seemed to sicken and die. Once he woke when I was in his room and thought I had come to comfort him. I leaned over his bed, and he reached up and clasped me to him, and I drank. Ah, the sweetness of Charles! Oh, the strength and beauty of him! The old man was damned upset when he up and died, Sour Billy put in. Personally, he'd been delighted. Charles Garou had always been telling his father that Billy was too hard on the niggers and trying to get him dismissed. As if you could get any work from a nigger by being soft. Yes, Garou was distraught, said Julian. How fortunate that I was there to comfort him in his grief. His son's best friend. How often he told me afterward that I had become like a fourth son to him as we mourned. Sour Billy remembered it well. Julian had handled it real good. The younger sons had let down the old man. Jean-Pierre was a drunken lout, and Philip, a weakling who wept like a woman at his brother's funeral, but Damon Julian had been a tower of manly strength. They had buried Charles out back of the plantation in the family cemetery. The ground being so damp in these parts, he'd been laid to rest in a big marble mausoleum with a winged victory on top of it. It stayed nice and cool in there, even in the heat of August. Sour Billy had gone into the tomb many a time in the years since, to drink and piss on Charles's coffin. Once he dragged a nigger wench in there with him, slapped her around a little, and had her 3-4 times, just so old Charles's ghost could see the proper way to handle niggers. Charles had only been the beginning, Sour Billy recalled. 6 months later, Jean-Pierre rode off to do some whoring and gambling in the city, and he never did ride back. And it wasn't long after that when poor timid Philip got himself all ripped up by some kind of animal in the woods. Old Garou was real sick at heart by then, but Damon Julian was by his side through all of it, helping. Finally, Garou adopted him, and wrote a new will, leaving him just about everything. There was a night not too long after that, Sour Billy would never forget, when Damon Julian had demonstrated how thoroughly old René Garou was in his power. It was up in the old man's bedroom. Valerie was there, and Adrian, and Elaine as well. They'd all been living in the big house, since any friend of Julian's was welcome in the Garou home. They watched with Sour Billy while Damon Julian stood at the side of the great canopied bed and pierced the old man through with his black eyes and his easy smile, and told him the truth, all the truth about what had happened to Charles and Jean-Pierre and Philip. Julian was wearing Charles's signet ring, and Valerie had its twin on a chain about her neck. Hers had once belonged to the missing Jean-Pierre. She had not wanted to wear it. The thirst was on her, but she wanted to finish old Garou quickly, without talk. But Damon Julian stilled her protests with soft words and cold eyes. So she wore the ring and stood meekly and listened. When Julian had finished his story, Garou had been shaking, his rheumy eyes full of tears and pain and hate. And then, astoundingly, Damon Julian had told Sour Billy to hand the old man his knife. "He ain't dead yet, Mr. Julian," Billy had protested. "He'll cut your guts out." But Julian only glanced at him and smiled. So Sour Billy reached back and produced the knife and put it into Garou's wrinkled, liver-spotted grasp. The old man's hands shook so bad that Billy had been afraid he was going to drop the damn thing, but somehow he hung on to it. Damon Julian sat on the edge of the bed. "René," he said, "my friends are thirsty." His voice was so quiet, so liquid. That was all he had to say. Elaine produced a glass, a fine crystal etched with the family crest, and old René Garou carefully cut open the vein in his wrist and filled the glass with his own steaming red blood, crying and trembling all the while. Valerie and Elaine and Adrian passed the glass from hand to hand, but it was left to Damon Julian to finish it off, while Garou bled to death in his bed. "Garou gave us some good years," Kurt was saying. His words drew Sour Billy out of his memories. "Rich and safe, off by ourselves. The city here whenever we wanted it. Food and drink, and niggers to wait on us. A fancy girl every month." "Yet it ended," Julian said a trifle wistfully. "All things must end, Kurt. Do you mourn it?" "Things aren't the same," Kurt admitted. "Dust everywhere, the house rotting, rats. I'm not anxious to move again, Damon. Out in the world, we are never secure. After a hunt, there is always the fear, the hiding, the running. I do not want that again." Julian smiled sardonically. "Inconvenient, true, but not without spice. You are young, Kurt. Remember, however they may hound you, you are the master. You will see them dead, and their children's children. The Garou home falls into ruin. It is nothing. All these things the cattle make fall into ruin. I have seen Rome itself turn to dust. Only we go on." He shrugged. "And we may yet find another like René Garou." "So long as we are with you," Cynthia said anxiously. She was a slight, pretty woman with brown eyes, and she had become Julian's favorite since he had dismissed Valerie. But even Sour Billy could tell that she was insecure about her position. "It is worse when we are alone," "So you do not wish to leave me?" Damon Julian asked her, smiling. "No," she said. "Please." Kurt and Armand were looking at him as well. Julian had begun sending away his companions a month ago, very suddenly. Valerie was exiled first, as she had begged, though he sent her upriver, not with the troublesome Jean, but with dark, handsome Raymond, who was cruel and strong and, some said, Julian's own son. Raymond would be sure to keep her safe, Julian said mockingly, as Valerie knelt before him that night. Jean was given his leave the next night and went off alone, and Sour Billy thought that would be the end of it. He was wrong. Damon Julian had some new thought in his head, and so George was sent away a week later, and then Cara and Vincent, and then the others, alone or in pairs. Now those who remained knew that none of them were safe. "Ah," Julian said to Cynthia, amused. "Well, there are only five of us now. If we are careful and we make each fancy girl last for, oh, a month or two, sipping slowly, as it were, why then, I believe we can last until winter. By then, one of the others will have sent word, perhaps. We shall see. Until then, you may stay, darling. And Michelle as well. And you, Kurt." Armand looked stricken. "And me?" he blurted. "Damon, please." "Is it the thirst, Armand? Is that why you tremble? Control yourself. Will you rip and tear when we reach these friends of Billy's?" "You know how I frown on that." His eyes narrowed. "I am still thinking about you, Armand." Armand looked down at his empty cup. "I'll stay," Thor Billy announced. "Ah," said Damon Julian. "Of course. Why, Billy, what would we do without you?" Sour Billy Tipton didn't much like the smile Julian wore then, but there wasn't nothing to be done about it. A short time later, they set off to the place Billy had promised to show them. The house was outside the Vieux Carré, in the American section of New Orleans, but within walking distance. Damon Julian went in front, walking through the narrow gas-lit streets arm in arm with Cynthia, wearing a private ghost of a smile as he regarded the iron balconies, the gates opening on courtyards with their flambeaux and their fountains, the gas lamps atop iron poles. Sour Billy directed them. Soon they were in a darker, raw part of town, where the buildings were wood or crumbly, tabby brick, made of ground oyster shells and sand. Even the gas lines had not extended this far, though the city had had its gas works for more than 20 years. At the corners, oil lamps, swung from heavy iron chains, hung diagonally across the streets, and supported by great hooks driven into the sides of buildings. They burned with a sensual smoky light. Julian and Cynthia passed from pools of light into shadow, back into light, then again into shadow. Sour Billy and the others followed. A party of three men stepped out from an alley and crossed their path. Julian ignored them, but one of the men glimpsed Sour Billy as he passed beneath the light. "You," he said. Sour Billy turned his stare on them, saying nothing. They were young Creoles, half-drunk and therefore dangerous. "I know you, monsieur," the man said. He stepped up to Sour Billy, his dark face flush with drink and anger. "Have you forgotten me? I was with Georges Montry the day you affronted him in the French Exchange." Sour Billy recognized him. "Well, well," he said. "Monsieur Montry vanished one June night, after an evening of gaming at the St. Louis," the man said stiffly. "I'm real grieved," Sour Billy said. "I guess he must have won too much and got robbed for his trouble." "He lost, monsieur. He had been losing steadily for some weeks. He had nothing worth stealing. No, I do not think it was robbery. I think it was you, Mr. Tipton. He had been asking about you. He meant to deal with you like the trash you are. You are no gentleman, monsieur, or I would call you out. If you dare show your face in the Vieux Carré again, however, you have my word that I shall whip you through the streets like a nigger. Do you hear me?" "I hear," said Sour Billy. He spat on the man's boot.
The Creole swore, and his face paled with rage. He took a step forward and reached out for Sourbilly, but Damon Julien stepped between them and stopped the man with a hand against his chest. "Monsieur," Julien said in a voice like wine and honey. The man halted, confused. "I can assure you that Mr. Tipton did no harm to your friend, sir." "Who are you?" Even half drunk, the Creole clearly recognized that Julien was a different sort of person than Sourbilly. His fine clothes, cool features, cultured voice, all marked him a gentleman. Julian's eyes glittered dangerously in the lamplight. "I am Mr. Tipton's employer," Julien said. "May we discuss this affair somewhere other than the public street? I know a place further on where we can sit beneath the moon and sip drinks while we talk. Will you let me buy your friends and you a refreshment?" One of the other Creoles stepped up beside his friend. "Let us hear him out, Richard." Grudgingly, the man consented. "Billy," Damon Julien said, "do show us the way." Sourbilly Tipton suppressed a smile, nodded, and led them off. A block away, they turned into an alley and followed it back into a dark court. Sourbilly sat down on the edge of a scum-covered pool. The water soaked through the seat of his pants, but he didn't care. "What is this place?" demanded Montree's friend. "This is no tavern." "Well," said Sourbilly Tipton. "Well, I must have turned wrong." The other Creoles had entered the court, followed by the rest of Julian's party. Kurt and Cynthia stood by the mouth of the alley. Armand moved closer to the fountain. "I do not like this," one of the men said. "What is the meaning of this?"
"Meaning?" asked Damon Julien. "Ah, a dark court, the moonlight, a pool. Your friend Montree died in just such a place, monsieur.
Not in this place, but one very much like it."
"No, do not look at Billy. He bears no blame."
"If you have a quarrel, take it up with me."
"You," said Montree's friend.
"As you will. Permit me to retire a moment. My companions will act as my seconds."
"Certainly," said Julien. The man moved away, conferred briefly with his two companions. One of them stepped forward. Sourbilly rose from the pool's edge and met him.
"I'm Mr. Julian's second," Sourbilly said. "You want to talk terms?"
"You are no proper second," the man began. He had a long, pretty face and dark brown hair.
"Terms," Sourbilly repeated. His hand went behind his back. "Me? I'd favor knives."
The man gave a small grunt and staggered backward. He looked down in terror. Sourbilly's knife was buried hilt deep in his gut, and a slow red stain was spreading across his vest.
"God!"
the man whimpered.
"That's only me, though,"
Sourbilly continued.
"And I'm not a gentleman. No, sir. Not a proper second. Knives ain't no proper weapon, neither."
The man dropped to his knees, and his friends suddenly noticed and started forward in alarm.
"Mr. Julien, now, he's got different ideas."
"His weapon," Billy smiled, "is teeth." Julien took Montree's friend, the one called Richard. The other turned to run. Cynthia embraced him by the alley and gave him a lingering wet kiss. He thrashed and struggled, but could not break free of her embrace. Her pale hands brushed the back of his neck, and long nails, sharp and thin as razors, slid across his veins. Her mouth and tongue swallowed his scream. Sourbilly pulled free his knife while Armand bent to attend to his whimpering victim. In the moonlight, the blood running down the blade looked almost black. Billy started to clean it in the pool, then hesitated. He raised the knife to his lips and licked at the flat of it tentatively. Then he made a face. Tasted awful. Not like in his dreams at all. Still, that would change when Julien made him over, he knew. Sourbilly washed his knife and sheathed it. Damon Julien had given Richard over to Kurt and was standing solitary, gazing up at the moon. Sourbilly approached him.
"Saved us some money," he said.
Julien smiled. Chapter 11.
Aboard the steamer Fever Dream, Natchez, August 1857. For Abner Marsh, that night went on and on. He had a small snack to settle his stomach and calm his fears, and soon thereafter retired to his cabin. But sleep would not take him easily. For hours he lay staring at the shadows, his mind racing, his thoughts a jumble of suspicion and anger and guilt. Beneath the thin, starchy sheet, Marsh sweated like a hog. When he did sleep, he tossed and turned and woke often and dreamed flushed, furtive, and coherent dreams of blood and burning steamboats and yellow teeth and Joshua Anton Rourke standing pale and cold beneath a scarlet light with fever and death behind his angry eyes. The next day was the longest day Abner Marsh had ever known. All his thoughts led him round and round and back to the same place. By noon he knew what he must do. He'd been caught, no help for it. He had to fess up and have it out with Joshua. If that meant the end of their partnership, so be it. Although the thought of losing his fever dream made Marsh feel sick and weary, as full of despair as he had been the day he'd seen the splinters the ice had made of his steamers. It would be the end of him, Marsh thought. And perhaps it was all he deserved for betraying Joshua's trust. But things could not go on as they were. Joshua ought to hear the tale from his own mouth, too, Marsh decided, which meant that he had to get to him before that woman Catherine did. He spread the word. "I want to be told the moment he gets back," he said, "no matter when it is or what I'm about. Come fetch me. You hear?" Then Abner Marsh waited and took what solace he could in a lovely dinner of roast pork and green beans and onions, with half a blueberry pie afterward. 2 hours shy of midnight, one of the crew came to him. "Captain York's come back, Captain. Got some folks with him. Mr. Jeffers is settling them into cabins." "Has Joshua gone up to his cabin?" Marsh asked. The man nodded. Marsh snatched up his walking stick and made for the stairs. Outside York's cabin, he hesitated briefly, threw back his ample shoulders, and brought the head of his stick sharply against the door. York opened on the third knock. "Come in, Abner," he said, smiling. Marsh stepped inside, shut the door behind him, and leaned against it, while York crossed the room and resumed what he'd been doing. He'd set out a silver tray and three glasses. Now he reached for a fourth. "I'm glad you came up. I've brought some people aboard I want you to meet. They'll be coming up for a drink as soon as they've settled into their staterooms." York pulled a bottle of his private drink from the wine rack, produced his knife, and sliced off the wax seal. "Never mind about that," Marsh said brusquely. "Joshua, we gotta talk." York set the bottle down on the tray and turned to face Marsh. "Oh? What of?" "You sound upset, Abner." "I got spare keys to every lock on this boat. Mr. Jeffers keeps them for me in the safe. When you went into Natchez, I got myself a key and searched your cabin." Joshua York scarcely moved, but when he heard Marsh's words, his lips pressed together tightly. Abner Marsh looked him straight in the eye, as a man ought at a time like this, and felt coldness there, and the fury of betrayal. He would almost rather Joshua had screamed at him, or even drawn a weapon, than look at him with such eyes. "Did you find anything of interest?" York asked finally, in a voice gone flat. Abner Marsh wrenched himself away from Joshua's gray eyes and jabbed his stick at his desk. "Your ledgers," he said. "Full of dead men." York said nothing. He glanced briefly at the desk, frowned, and sat himself down in one of his armchairs and poured out a measure of his thick, vile drink. He sipped it, and only then gestured to Marsh. "Sit down," he commanded. When Marsh was seated across from him, York added one final word. "Why?" "Why?" Marsh said a bit angrily. "Maybe 'cause I'm tired of having myself a partner who don't tell me nothing, who don't trust me. We had a bargain." "I know that, Joshua. And I'm sorry, if that matters. Sorry I did it, and a damn sight sorry I got caught." He grinned ruefully. "That Catherine saw me leave. She'll be talking to you. Look, I should have come direct to you, told you what was eating at me,
I'm doing that now. Maybe it's too late, but here I am. Joshua, I love this boat of ours as much as I ever loved anything. And the day we take the horns off the Eclipse is going to be the grandest day of my life. But I've been thinking, and I know I got to give up that day, and this steamer, rather than go on like we are. This river is full of scoundrels and sharpers and Bible thumpers and abolitionists and Republicans and all manner of queer folk. But you're the queerest of the lot, I swear. The night hours, I don't mind. They don't fret me none. Books full of dead people, that's something else. But it ain't nobody's business what a man cares to read. Why, I knew a pilot on the Grand Turk kept books that'd make even Carl Fram turn red with shame. But these stops of yours, these trips off by yourself, it's those I can't suffer no more. You're slowing my steamer, damn you. You're ruining our name before we even made it. And Joshua, that ain't all. I seen you the night you come back from New Madrid. You had blood on your hands. Deny it if you will. Cuss me if you want. But I know. You had blood on your hands. Damn if you didn't. Joshua York took a long drink and frowned as he refilled his glass. When he looked at Marsh, the ice had melted in his eyes. He looked thoughtful. Are you proposing we dissolve our partnership? He asked. Marsh felt like a mule had kicked him in the stomach. If you want, you got that right. I ain't got the money to buy you out, of course. But you'd have the fever dream, and I could keep my Eli Reynolds and maybe show a profit with her. Send you a little as it come in. Is that the way you'd prefer it? Marsh glared at him. Damn you, Joshua, you know it ain't. Abner, York said, I need you. I cannot run the fever dream by myself. I am learning a little of piloting, and I've become somewhat more familiar with the river and its ways, but we both know I am no steamboatman. If you left, half of the crew would go with you. Mr. Jeffers and Mr. Blake and Harry Mike for certain, and no doubt others. They are loyal to you. I can order them to stay on with you, Marsh offered. I would rather you stayed on. If I agree to overlook your trespass, can we continue as before? The lump in Abner Marsh's throat was so thick he thought he would choke on it. He swallowed, and said the hardest thing that he had ever said in all his born days. No. I see, said Joshua. I got to trust my partner, Marsh said. He's got to trust me. You talk to me, Joshua. You tell me what all this is about, and you got yourself a partner. Joshua York grimaced and sipped slowly at his drink, considering. You will not believe me, he said at last. It is a more outlandish story than any of Mr. Fram's. Try it out on me. Can't do no harm. Oh, but it can, Abner. It can. York's voice was serious. He put down his glass and went over to the bookcase. When you searched, he said, did you look at my books? Yes, Marsh admitted. York pulled out one of the untitled volumes in the leather bindings, returned to his chair, and opened it to a page full of crabbed characters. Had you been able to read it, he said, this book and its companion volumes might have enlightened you. I looked at it. It'd make no sense. Of course not, York said. Abner, what I am about to tell you will be difficult for you to accept. Whether you accept it or not, however, it must not be repeated outside the confines of this cabin. Is that understood? Yes. York's eyes wandered. I want no mistake this time, Abner. Is that understood? I said yes, Joshua. Marsh grumbled, offended. Very well, Joshua said. He put his finger on the page. This code is a relatively simple cipher, Abner, but to break it you must first realize that the language involved is a primitive dialect of Russian, one that has not been spoken in some hundreds of years. The original papers transcribed in this volume were very, very old.
They told the story of some people who lived and died in the area north of the Caspian Sea many centuries ago. He paused. Pardon, not people. Russian is not among my best languages, but I believe the proper word is Oderutin. What? Said Marsh. That is only one term, of course. Other languages have other names. Kruvnik, Vedomek, Vishchi, Vilkakis, and Vrukolak as well, although those two have somewhat different meanings from the others. You're talking gibberish, Marsh said, although some of the words Joshua was reciting did kind of ring familiar, and sounded vaguely like the gibble-gabble Smith and Brown were always spouting. I won't give you the African names for them, then, said Joshua, or the Asian, or any of the others. Does Nosferatu have meaning for you? Marsh regarded him blankly. Joshua York sighed. How about vampire? Abner Marsh knew that one. What kind of story you trying to tell me? He said gruffly. A vampire story, said York with a sly smile. Surely you've heard them before. The living dead, immortal, prowlers of the night. Creatures without souls, damned to eternal wandering. They sleep in coffins filled with their native earth, shun daylight and the cross, and each night they rise and drink the blood of the living. They are shape-changers as well, able to take the form of a bat or a wolf. Some, who utilize the wolf form frequently, are called werewolves, and thought to be a different species entirely, but that is an error. They are two sides of a single dark coin, Abner. Vampires can also become mist, and their victims become vampires themselves. It is a wonder, multiplying so, that vampires have not displaced living men entirely. Unfortunately, they have weaknesses as well as vast powers. Though their strength is frightening, they cannot enter a house where they have not been invited, neither as human nor animal nor mist. They wield great animal magnetism, however, the force Mesmer wrote about, and can often compel their victims to ask them in. But a cross will send them fleeing. Garlic can bar them, and they cannot cross running water. No, they look much like you and I. They have no souls, and therefore are not reflected in mirrors. Holy water will burn them. Silver is anathema to them. Daylight can destroy them if dawn catches them away from their coffins. And by severing their heads from their bodies and driving a wooden stake through their hearts, one can rid the world of them permanently. Joshua sat back and took up his drink, sipped, smiled. Those vampires, Abner, he said. He tapped the book with a long finger. This is the story of a few of them. They are real. Old, eternal, and real. A 16th century Oderotin wrote this book about those who had gone before him. A vampire. Abner Marsh said nothing. You do not believe me, said Joshua York. It ain't easy, Marsh admitted. He tugged at the coarse hairs of his beard. There were other things he didn't say. Joshua's talk of vampires didn't bother him half so much as his own disquiet about where Joshua himself fit in. Let's not worry if I believe or not, Marsh said. If I can take Mr. Fram's stories, I can at least listen to yours. Go on. Joshua smiled. You're a clever man, Abner. You should be able to figure things out by yourself. I don't feel so damn clever, Marsh said. Tell me. York sipped, shrugged. They are my enemies. They are real, Abner, and they are here, all along your river. Through books like these, through research in newspapers, through much painstaking work, I have tracked them from the mountains of Eastern Europe, the forests of the Germans and Poles, the steppes of Russia. Here, to your Mississippi Valley, to the New World. I know them. I bring an end to them and all the things they have ever been. He smiled.
Now do you comprehend my books, Abner? And the blood on my hands?
Abner Marsh thought on that for a spell before he replied. He finally said,
I recollect how you wanted mirrors all up and down the Grand Saloon instead of oil paintings and such.
For protection?
Exactly. And silver. Did you ever know a steamer to wear so much silver?
No. And, of course, we have the river. The old Devil River. The Mississippi. Running water such as the world has never seen. The fever dream is a sanctuary. I can hunt them, you see, but they cannot come near us.
I'm surprised you didn't tell Toby to season everything with garlic,
Marsh said.
I thought of it, Joshua said. But I dislike garlic.
Marsh mulled it all over.
Just say I believe this, he said. I ain't saying that so, but just for the sake of argument, I'll go along. Still got some things that bother me. How come you didn't tell me before?
If I'd told you at the planter's house, you'd never have let me buy into your company. I need the power to go where I must.
And how come you only go out by night?
They prowl by night. It is easier to find them when they go abroad than when they are safe in their sanctuaries hidden. I know the ways of those I hunt. I keep their hours.
And those friends of yours, Simon and the rest?
Simon has been my associate for a long time. The others have joined me more recently. They know the truth. They assist me in my mission. As I hope you shall henceforth.
Joshua chuckled. Don't worry, Abner. All of us are as mortal as you are.
Marsh fingered his beard.
Let me have a drink, he said.
When York leaned forward, he added quickly,
No, not that stuff, Joshua. Something else. Got any whiskey?
York rose and poured him a glass. Marsh drained it straight away.
I can't say I like any of this. Dead folks, blood drinking, all that stuff. I never believed in none of it.
Abner, this is a dangerous game I play. I never meant to involve you or your crew in any of it. I would never have told you as much as I have, but you insisted. If you wish to deal yourself out, I have no objections. Do as I tell you. Run the fever dream for me, that is all I ask. I will deal with them. Do you doubt my capacity to do so?
Marsh looked at the easy way Joshua sat, remembered the force behind those gray eyes, the strength of his handshake.
No, I have been honest in many of things I have said to you.
Joshua continued. My purpose is not my only obsession. I love this steamer as you do, Abner, and share many of your dreams for her. I want to pilot her, to know the river. I want to be on hand the day we outrun the eclipse. Believe me when I say...
There was a knock on the door.
Marsh was startled.
Joshua York smiled and shrugged.
My friends from Natchez come up for their drink, he explained.
A moment, he called loudly.
He said to Marsh in a low, urgent voice, Think about all I have said, Abner. We can talk again if you'd like, but keep my faith and talk to no one about this. I have no wish to involve others.
You got my word, Marsh said.
Hell, who'd believe it?
Joshua smiled.
If you would be so kind as to let in my guests while I pour us some drinks, he said.
Marsh got up and opened the door. Outside, a man and a woman stood talking in soft whispers. Beyond them, Marsh saw the moon standing between the chimneys like a glowing decoration. He heard snatches of a bawdy song from Natchez Under the Hill, faint in the distance.
Come on in, he said.
The strangers were a fine-looking couple, Marsh saw as they entered. The man was young, almost boyish, very lean and handsome, with black hair and fair skin and heavy, sensual lip. He had a fierce, cold look in his black eyes when he glanced briefly at Marsh. And the woman. Abner Marsh looked at her and found it hard to look away. She was a real beauty. Long hair, black as midnight. Skin as fine as milk-white silk. High cheekbones. Her waist was so small Marsh wanted to reach out and see if his big hands would go all the way around. He looked up at her face instead and found her staring at him. Her eyes were incredible. Marsh had never seen eyes that color before. A deep, velvety purple, full of promise. He felt like he could drown in those eyes. They reminded him of a color he'd seen on the river once or twice at twilight, a strange violet stillness glimpsed only briefly before darkness came in for good and all. Marsh stared into those eyes helplessly for what seemed like ages until the woman finally gave him an enigmatic smile and turned briskly away. Joshua had filled four glasses, for Marsh a tumbler of whiskey, for himself and the others his private stock. "I am pleased to have you here," he said as he served the drinks. "I trust your accommodations are satisfactory." "Quite," the man said, taking up his glass and looking at it dubiously. Remembering his own taste of the stuff, Marsh didn't blame him one bit. "You have a lovely steamboat, Captain York," the woman said in a warm voice. "I shall enjoy taking passage on it." "I hope we shall be traveling together for some time," Joshua replied graciously. "As for the fever dream, I am very proud of her, but your compliments should really be directed to my partner." He gestured. "If you will permit me to make introductions, this formidable gentleman here is Captain Abner Marsh, my associate in Fever River Packets, and the real master of the fever dream, if truth be told." The woman smiled at Abner again, while the man nodded stiffly. "Abner," York continued, "may I present Mr. Raymond Ortega of New Orleans and his fiancée, Miss Valerie Mersault?" "Real glad to have you with us," Marsh said awkwardly. Joshua raised his glass. "A toast," he said, "to new beginnings." They echoed his words and drank. Chapter 12. Aboard the steamer Fever Dream, Mississippi River, August 1857. Abner Marsh had a mind that was not unlike his body. It was big all around, ample in size and capacity, and he crammed all sorts of things into it. It was strong as well. When Abner Marsh took something in his hand, it did not easily slip away, and when he took something in his head, it was not easily forgotten. He was a powerful man with a powerful brain, but body and mind shared one other trait as well. They were deliberate. Some might even say slow. Marsh did not run, he did not dance, he did not scamper or slide along. He walked with a straightforward, dignified gait that nonetheless got him where he wanted to go. So it was with his mind. Abner Marsh was not quick in word or thought, but he was far from stupid. He chewed over things thoroughly, but at his own pace. As the fever dream steamed out of Natchez, Marsh was only beginning to mull over the story he had gotten from Joshua York. The more he mulled, the more he fretted. If you could credit it, Joshua's outlandish story about hunting for vampires did explain a respectable amount of the strange goings-on that had plagued the fever dream, but it didn't explain everything. Abner Marsh's slow but tenacious memory kept throwing up questions and recollections that floated around in his head like dead wood floats on the river. Good for nothing, but bothersome. Simon, for instance, licking up mosquitoes. Joshua's extraordinary night vision. And most of all, the way he'd raged the day Marsh had come barging into his cabin. He hadn't come outside, neither, to see them run against the southerner. That worried Marsh considerably. It was fine for Joshua to say he kept night hours on account of these vampires of his, but that still didn't explain the way he'd acted that afternoon. Most folks Abner Marsh knew kept normal daylight hours, but that didn't mean they wouldn't hoist themselves out of bed at 3 a.m. if there was something interesting to gawk at. Marsh badly felt the need to talk it over with someone. Jonathan Jeffers was a demon for book learning, and Carl Fram probably knew every damn fool story that had ever been told along the damn fool river. Either of them would likely know everything there was to know about these vampires. Only he couldn't talk to them. He'd promised Joshua, and he was beholden to the man, and wasn't about to go and betray him a second time. Not without cause, anyway.
and all he had were half-formed suspicions. The suspicions got more formed every day, though, as the fever dream loafed down the Mississippi. Generally, they ran by day now and tied up at twilight, then set out again the next morning. They made better time than they had before Natchez, which heartened Marsh. Other changes pleased him less. Marsh did not cotton to Joshua's new friends. He decided in short order that they were every bit as queer as Joshua's old friends, keeping the same night hours and all. Raymond Ortega struck Marsh as a restless, untrustworthy sort. The man wouldn't keep to passenger territory, and kept turning up in places he didn't belong. He was polite enough in a haughty, indolent fashion, but Marsh got a chill off him. Valerie was warmer, but almost as disturbing, with her soft words and provocative smiles, and those eyes of hers. She didn't act like Raymond Ortega's fiancée at all. Right from the first, she was real friendly with Joshua. Too damned friendly, if you ask Marsh. It was bound to cause trouble. A proper lady would have stayed to the ladies' cabin. But Valerie spent her nights with Joshua in the Grand Saloon, and sometimes took walks on the deck with him. Marsh even heard one man say that they'd gone up to Joshua's cabin together. He tried to warn York about the kind of scandalous talk that was starting up, but Joshua just shrugged it off. "Let them have their scandal, Abner, if it pleases them," he said. "Valerie is interested in our boat, and it is my pleasure to show it to her. There is nothing between us but friendship. You have my word." He looked almost sad when he said that. "I might wish that it were otherwise, but that is the truth." "You better be goddamn careful what you're wishing," Marsh said bluntly. "That Ortega might have his own opinions on the matter. He's from New Orleans, probably one of those Creoles. They'll fight a duel over just about any damn thing, Joshua." Joshua York smiled. "I have no fear of Raymond, but I thank you for your warning, Abner. Now, please, let Valerie and me conduct our own affairs." Marsh did just that, but not comfortably. He was certain that Ortega would make trouble sooner or later, especially when Valerie Messault went on to become Joshua's constant companion during the nights that followed. The goddamned woman was blinding him to the dangers all about him, but there wasn't a thing Marsh could do about it. And that was only the start of it. At each landing, more strangers came aboard, and Joshua always gave them cabins. At Bayou Sara, he and Valerie left the fever dream one night and returned with a pale, heavy man named Jean Ardant. A few minutes downriver, they'd put in at a woodyard, and Ardant had gone and fetched this sallow-faced dandy named Vincent. At Baton Rouge, four more strangers had taken passage. At Donaldsonville, another three. And then there were those dinners. As his strange company began to grow, Joshua York ordered a table set up in the Texas parlor, and there he would dine at midnight with his companions, new and old. Supper they took with everyone else in the main cabin, but these dinners were private. The custom started in Bayou Sara. Abner Marsh allowed once to Joshua how the idea of a regular meal at midnight took his fancy, but that didn't get him invited. Joshua only smiled, and the meals went on, the number of diners growing each night. Finally, Marsh's curiosity got the better of him, and he managed to walk by the parlor a couple of times to glance in the window. There wasn't much to see, just some folks eating and talking. The oil lamps were dim and subdued, the curtains half drawn. Joshua sat at the head of the table, Simon on his right-hand side, and Valerie to his left. Everybody was sipping from glasses of Joshua's vile elixir, several bottles of which had been uncorked. The first time Marsh wandered by, Joshua was talking animatedly, and the rest were listening. Valerie stared at him almost worshipfully. The second time Marsh peeked in, Joshua was listening to Jean Ardant, one hand resting casually on the tablecloth. As Marsh watched, Valerie placed her own hand on top of it. Joshua glanced at her and smiled fondly. Valerie smiled back. Abner Marsh looked quickly for Raymond Ortega, muttered, "Goddamn fool woman," under his breath, and hurried away scowling. Marsh tried to make sense of it, Of all these queer strangers, these odd goings-on, of all Joshua York had told him about vampires, it wasn't easy, and the more he thought on it, the more confused he got. The library on the Fever Dream had no books about vampires or anything like that, and he wasn't about to go stealing into Joshua's cabin again. At Baton Rouge, he took himself into town and bought a few rounds at some likely grog shops, hoping to find out something that way. When he could, he'd introduce the subject of vampires into the talk, usually by turning to his drinking companions and saying, "Say, you ever heard anything about vampires along the river?" He figured that was safer than raising the subject on the steamer, where the very word might start some bad talk. A few folks laughed at him or gave him odd looks. One free man of color, a burly, soot-black fellow with a broken nose whom Marsh accosted in a particularly smoky tavern, ran off as soon as Marsh asked his question. Marsh tried to run after him, but was soon left behind, wheezing. Others seemed to know considerable about vampires, though none of the stories had a damn thing to do with the Mississippi. All the stuff he'd heard from Joshua's lips about crosses and garlic and coffins full of dirt, he heard repeated, and more besides. Marsh took to watching York and his companions closely at supper, and afterward in the Grand Saloon. Vampires didn't eat nor drink, he'd been told. But Joshua and the others drank copious amounts of wine and whiskey and brandy when they weren't sipping York's private stock, and all of them were only too glad to do justice to a nice chicken or pork chop. Joshua was always wearing his silver ring with its sapphire, big as a pigeon's eye, and none of them seemed bothered by all the silver about the cabin. They used the silverware proper enough when they ate, better than most of the Fever Dream's crew. And when the chandeliers were lit by night, the mirrors all up and down the main cabin gleamed brilliantly, and crowds of finely dressed reflections came to life on either side of them, and danced and drank and played cards, just like the real folks in the real saloon. Abner Marsh, night after night, found himself looking into those mirrors. Joshua was always there where he was supposed to be, smiling, laughing, gliding from mirror to mirror, arm in arm with Valerie, talking politics with a passenger, listening to Fram's river yarns, sharing private talks with Simon or Jean Ardent. Each night a thousand Joshua Yorks walked the Fever Dream's carpeted deck, each as alive and grand as all the others. His friends cast reflections, too. That ought to have been enough, but Marsh's slow, suspicious mind was still disquieted. It wasn't until Donaldsonville that he hit on a plan to stop his fretting. He went into town with a canteen and filled it up with holy water from a Papist church near to the river. Then he took aside the boy who waited there end of the table and gave him 50 cents. "You fill Captain York's water glass from this tonight, you hear?" Marsh told him. "I'm playing him a joke." During supper, the waiter kept looking at York expectantly, waiting for the joke to get funny. He was disappointed. Joshua drank down the holy water, easy as you please. "Well, damn," Marsh muttered to himself afterwards. "That sure ought to settle it." But it didn't. And that night Abner Marsh excused himself from the Grand Saloon to do some thinking. He'd been sitting up on the Texas porch for a couple of hours alone, his chair leaned back and his feet up on the railing, when he heard the rustled skirts on the stairway. Valerie had drifted over and stood close beside him, smiling down. "Good evening, Captain Marsh," she said. Abner Marsh's chair thumped back to the deck as he pulled his boots off the rail, scowling. "Passengers ain't supposed to be up on the Texas," he said, trying to hide his annoyance. "It was so warm down below. I thought it might be cooler up here." "Well, that's true," Marsh replied uncertainly. He didn't know quite what to say next. The truth was, women had always made him feel uncomfortable. They had no place in a steamboatman's world, and Marsh had never quite known how to deal with them. Beautiful women made him even more ill at ease, and Valerie was as disconcerting as any fancy New Orleans matron. She stood with one slender hand curled lightly around a carved post, looking off over the water toward Donaldsonville. "We'll reach New Orleans tomorrow, won't we?" she asked. Marsh stood up. figuring it probably wasn't polite to be sitting down with Valerie standing.
"Yes, ma'am," he said. "We ain't but a few hours upriver, and I mean to steam in sparkling, so it won't take hardly no time at all."
"I see." She turned suddenly, and her pale, shapely face was very serious as she fixed him with her huge purple eyes. "Joshua says you are the true master of the fever dream. In some curious way, he has much respect for you. He will listen to you."
"We're partners," Marsh said.
"If your partner were in danger, would you come to his aid?"
Abner Marsh scowled, thinking of the vampire stories Joshua had told him, conscious of how pale and beautiful Valerie looked in the starlight, how deep her eyes were.
"Joshua knows he can come to me if he's got trouble," Marsh said. "A man who wouldn't help his partner ain't no kind of a man at all."
"Words," Valerie said scornfully, tossing back her thick black hair. The wind was in it, and it moved about her face as she spoke. "Joshua York is a great man, a strong man, a king. He deserves a better partner than you, Captain Marsh."
Abner Marsh felt the blood rushing to his face.
"What the hell are you talking about?" he demanded.
She smiled slyly.
"You broke into his cabin," she said.
Marsh was suddenly furious.
"He told you that?"
he said.
"God damn him, anyhow. We had it out over that. It ain't none of your never mind, neither."
"It is," she said. "Joshua is in great danger. He is bold, reckless. He must have help. I want to help him. But you, Captain Marsh, you only give him words."
"I don't have one goddamned idea what you're talking about, woman," Marsh said. "What kind of help does Joshua need?" "I offered to help him with these damned with some troubles he's got. But he didn't want to hear none of it."
Valerie's face softened suddenly.
"Would you really help him?" she asked.
"He's my goddamn partner."
"Then turn your steamer, Captain Marsh. Take us away from here. Take us to Natchez, to St. Louis. I don't care.
But not to New Orleans. We must not go to New Orleans tomorrow."
Abner Marsh snorted.
"Why the hell not?" he demanded.
When Valerie looked away instead of answering, he went on.
"This here is a steamboat, not some goddamn horse I can ride any place I got a notion. We got a schedule to keep. Folks who've taken passage with us, freight to discharge. We got to go to New Orleans."
He scowled.
"And what about Joshua?"
"He'll be asleep in his cabin come dawn," Valerie said. "When he wakes, we'll be safely upriver."
"Joshua's my partner," Marsh said. "Man's got to trust his partner. Maybe I spied on him once, but I ain't going to do anything like that again. Not for you and not for nobody. I ain't going to turn the fever dream around without telling him. Now, if Joshua comes to me and says he don't want to go on to New Orleans, hell, maybe we can talk it over, but not otherwise. You want me to go ask Joshua about this?"
"No,"
Valerie said quickly, alarmed.
"I got a good mind to tell him anyway," Marsh said. "He ought to know that you're plotting when his back is turned."
Valerie reached out and took him by the arm.
"Please, no," she implored.
Her grip was strong.
"Look at me, Captain Marsh."
Abner Marsh had been about to stomp away, but something in her voice compelled him to do as she bid. He looked into those purple eyes and kept looking.
"I'm not so hard to look at," she said, smiling. "I've seen you look before, Captain. You can't keep your eyes away from me, can you?"
Marsh's throat was very dry.
"I..."
Valerie tossed her hair back again in a wild, flamboyant gesture.
"Steamboats can't be the only thing you dream of, Captain Marsh. This boat is a cold lady, a poor lover. Warm flesh is better than wood and iron."
Marsh had never heard a woman talk like that before. He stood there thunderstruck.
"Come closer,"
Valerie said, and she pulled him to her, until he stood only inches from her upturned face.
"Look at me," he said. He could sense the trembling warmth of her, so near at hand,
and her eyes were vast purple pools, cool and silky and inviting.
"You want me, Captain?" she whispered.
"No,"
Marsh said. "Oh, you want me. I can see the desire in your eyes."
"No,"
Marsh protested.
"You're Joshua."
Valerie laughed, light, airy laughter, sensuous, musical. "Don't concern yourself with Joshua. Take what you want. You're afraid. That's why you fight it so. Don't be afraid."
Abner Marsh shook violently. And in the back of his mind, he realized with a start that he was trembling with lust. He had never wanted a woman so badly in his life. Yet somehow he was resisting, fighting it, though Valerie's eyes were drawing him closer, and the world was full of the scent of her.
"Take me to your cabin now," she whispered. "I'm yours tonight."
"You are?"
Marsh said weakly.
He felt sweat dripping off his brow, clouding his eyes.
"No," he muttered. "No, this ain't..."
"It can be," he said. "All you need do is promise."
"Promise?"
Marsh repeated hoarsely.
The violet eyes beckoned, blazed.
"Take us away. Away from New Orleans. Promise me that,
and you can have me.
You want it so much, I can feel it."
Abner Marsh brought his hands up, took her by the shoulders. He shook. His lips were dry. He wanted to crush her to him in a bear-like embrace, tumble her into his bed. But instead, somehow, he called up all the strength that was in him and shoved her away roughly. She cried out, stumbled, and went down to one knee. And Marsh, freed of those eyes, was roaring.
"Get out of here," he bellowed. "Get the hell off my Texas. What the hell kind of woman are you? Get the hell out of here. You're nothing but... Get out of here."
Valerie's face turned up again toward his, and her lips were drawn back.
"I can make you..."
He started angrily.
"No,"
Joshua York said firmly, quietly, from behind her. Joshua had appeared from the shadows as suddenly as if the darkness itself had taken on human form. Valerie stared at him, made a small noise deep in her throat, and fled down the stairs. Marsh felt so drained he could hardly stand up.
"God damn,"
he muttered. He pulled a handkerchief from a pocket and wiped the sweat off his brow. When he finished, Joshua was looking at him patiently.
"I don't know what you saw, Joshua, but it wasn't what you might think."
"I know exactly what it was, Abner," Joshua replied. He did not sound especially angry.
"I have been here nearly the whole time. When I noticed that Valerie had left the saloon, I went in search of her, and I heard your voices as I came up the stairs."
"I never heard you," Marsh said.
Joshua smiled.
"I can be very quiet when it suits my purposes, Abner."
"That woman," Marsh said, she
offered to... Hell, she's just a goddamn..."
The words would not come.
"She ain't no lady," he finished weakly. "Put her off, Joshua. Her and Ortega both."
"No."
"Why the hell not?" Marsh roared.
"You heard her."
"It makes no difference," Joshua said calmly. "If anything, what I heard makes me cherish her all the more. It was for me, Abner. She cares for me more than I had hoped. More than I dared expect." Abner Marsh cussed furiously.
"You ain't making one goddamn bit of sense."
Joshua smiled softly. "Perhaps not. This is not your concern, Abner. Leave Valerie to me. She will not cause trouble again. She was only afraid."
"Afraid of New Orleans?" Marsh said.
"Of vampires?"
"She knows."
"Yes."
"You sure you can handle whatever we're steaming into?"
Marsh said.
"If you want to skip New Orleans, say so, damn it. Valerie thinks..."
"What do you think, Abner?" York asked. Marsh looked at him for a long, long time. Then he said,
"I think we're going to New Orleans."
And both of them smiled. And so it was that the fever dream steamed into New Orleans the next morning, with Dapper Dan Albright at her wheel and Abner Marsh standing proudly out on her bridge in his captain's coat and his new cap. The sun burned hot in a blue, blue sky,
and every little snag and bluff reef was marked by golden ripples on the water. So the piloting came easy, and the steamer made crack time. The New Orleans levee was jammed with steamers and all manner of sailing ships. The river was alive to the music of their whistles and bells. Marsh leaned on his walking stick and watched the city loom large ahead, listening to the Fever Dream call out to the other boats with her landing bell and her loud, wild whistle. He had been to New Orleans many a time in his days on the river, but never like this, standing on the bridge of his own steamer, the biggest and fanciest and fleetest boat in sight. He felt like the lord of creation. Once they had tied up on the levee, though, there was work to do, freight to unload, consignments to hunt up for the return trip to St. Louis, advertisements to take in the local papers. Marsh decided that the company ought to see about opening a regular office down here. So he busied himself looking at likely sites and making arrangements for starting a bank account and hiring an agent. That night he dined at the St. Charles Hotel with Jonathan Jeffers and Carl Fram, but his mind kept wandering away from the food to the dangers that Valerie had seemed so afraid of, and he wondered what Joshua York was up to. When Marsh returned to the steamer, Joshua was talking with his companions in the Texas parlor, and nothing seemed amiss, though Valerie, seated by his side, looked somewhat sullen and abashed. Marsh went to sleep and put the whole thing from his mind, and in the days that followed he hardly thought on it at all. The Fever Dream kept him too busy by day, and by night he dined well in the city, bragged up his boat over drinks and taverns near the levee, strolled through the Vieux Carré, admiring the lovely Creole ladies, and all the courtyards and fountains and balconies. New Orleans was as fine as he remembered, Marsh thought at first. But then, gradually, a disquiet began to grow in him, a vague sense of wrongness that made him look at familiar things from new eyes. The weather was beastly. By day, the heat was oppressive, the air thick and wet, once you shut yourself off from the cool river breezes. Day and night, fumes rose up stinking from the open sewers, rich, rotten odors that wafted off the standing water like some vile perfume. No wonder New Orleans was so often taken by yellow fever, Marsh thought. The city was full of free men of color and lovely young quadroons and octoroons and griffs who dressed as fine as white women. But it was full of slaves as well. You saw them everywhere, running errands for their masters, sitting or milling forlornly in the slave pens on Moreau and Common Street, going in long chained lines to and from the great exchanges, cleaning out the gutters. Even down by the steamer landing, you couldn't escape the signs of slavery. The grand side-wheelers that plied the New Orleans trade were always taking black folks up and down the river, and Abner Marsh saw them come and go whenever he went down to the Fever Dream. The slaves rode in chains as often as not, sitting together miserably amidst the cargo, sweating in the heat of the furnaces. "I don't like it none," Marsh complained to Jonathan Jeffers. "It ain't clean, and I tell you I won't have none of it on the Fever Dream. Nobody is going to stink up my boat with that kind of stuff, you hear?" Jeffers gave him a wry look of appraisal. "Why, Captain, if we don't traffic in slaves, we stand to lose a pile of money. You're sounding like an abolitionist." "I ain't no damned abolitionist," Marsh said hotly. "But I mean what I said. If a gentleman wants to bring a slave or two along, servants and such, that's fine. I'll take him cabin passage or deck passage, don't matter none to me. But we ain't going to take him as freight, all chained up by some goddamned traitor." By their seventh night in New Orleans, Abner Marsh felt strangely sick of the city and anxious to be off. That night, Joshua York came down to supper with some river charts in his hand. Marsh had seen very little of his partner since their arrival. "How do you fancy New Orleans?" Marsh asked York as the other seated himself. "The city is lovely," York replied in an oddly troubled voice that made Marsh look up from the roll he was buttering. "I have nothing but admiration for the Vieux Carré. It is utterly unlike the other river towns we've seen, almost European. And some of the houses in the American section are grand as well. Nonetheless, I do not like it here." Marsh frowned. "Why is that?" I have a bad feeling, Abner. This city, the heat, the bright colors, the smells, the slaves, it is very alive, this New Orleans. But inside, I think it is rotten with sickness. Everything is so rich and beautiful here, the cuisine, the manners, the architecture. But beneath that, he shook his head. You see all those lovely courtyards, each boasting an exquisite well. And then you see the teamsters selling river water from barrels, and you realize that the well water is unfit to drink. You savor the rich sauces and the spices of the food, and then you learn that the spices are intended to disguise the fact that the meat is going bad. You wander through the St. Louis and cast your eyes upon all that marble and that delightful dome with the light pouring through it down onto the rotunda, and then you learn it is a famous slave mart where humans are sold like cattle. Even the graveyards are places of beauty here. No simple tombstones or wooden crosses, but great marble mausoleums, each prouder than the last, with statuary atop them and fine poetic sentiments inscribed in stone. But inside every one is a rotting corpse, full of maggots and worms. They must be imprisoned in stone because the ground is no good even for burying, and graves fill up with water, and pestilence hangs over this beautiful city like a pall. No, Abner, Joshua said with an odd, distant look in his gray eyes. I love beauty, but sometimes a thing lovely to behold conceals vileness and evil within. The sooner we are quit of this city, the better I shall like it. Hell, said Abner Marsh. Damned if I can say why, but I feel just the same way. Don't fret. We can get out of here real quick. Joshua York grimaced. Good, he said. But first, I have one final task. He moved aside his plate and opened the chart he had brought to the table with him. Tomorrow at dusk, I want to take the Fever Dream downriver. Downriver? Marsh said in astonishment. Hell, ain't nothing downstream of here for us. Some plantations, lots of Cajuns, swamps and bayous, and then the Gulf. Look, said York. His finger traced a path down the Mississippi. We follow the river down around through here, turn off onto this bayou, and proceed about a half dozen miles to here. It won't take us long, and we can return the next night to pick up our passengers for St. Louis. I want to make a brief landing here. He jabbed. Abner Marsh's hand stake was set in front of him, but he ignored it, leaning over to see where Joshua was pointing. Cypress Landing, he read from the chart. Well, I don't know. He looked around the main cabin, three quarters empty now, with no passengers aboard. Carl Fram, Whitey Blake, and Jack Eli were eating down to the far end of the table. Mr. Fram, Marsh called out. Come on down here a minute. When Fram arrived, Marsh pointed out the route York had traced. Can you pilot us down river and up this here bayou? Or do we draw too much? Fram shrugged. Some of them bayous is pretty wide and deep. Others you'd have trouble getting up with a yawl, let alone a steamer. But probably I can do it. There's landings and plantations down there, and other steamers get to them. Most of them ain't so big as this lady, though. It'll be slow going, I know that. We'll have to sound all the way, and be real careful of snags and sandbars. And likely as not, we'll have to saw off a mess of tree limbs if we don't want 'em knocking off our chimneys. He leaned over to look at the chart. Where are we going? I've been down that way once or twice. Place called Cypress Landing, said Marsh. Fram pursed his lips thoughtfully. Shouldn't be too bad. That's the old Garou plantation. Steamers used to put in there regular, taking sweet potatoes and sugar cane to New Orleans. Garou died, though, him and his whole family. And Cypress Landing ain't been heard of much since. Although now that I recollect, there's some funny stories about them parts. Why are we going there? A personal matter, said Joshua York. Just see that we get there, Mr. Fram. We'll leave tomorrow at dusk. You're the captain, Fram said. He went on back to his meal. Where the hell is my milk? Abner Marsh complained.
He looked around. The waiter, a slender Negro youth, lingered at the kitchen door. "Come on with my supper," Marsh bellowed at him, and the boy started visibly. Marsh turned back to York. "This trip," he said, "is it part of that thing you told me about?" "Yes," York said curtly.
"Dangerous?"
Marsh asked. Joshua York shrugged.
"I don't like this none," Marsh said. "This vampire stuff?"
He dropped his voice to a whisper when he said vampire.
"It will soon be over, Abner. I will make a call at this plantation, attend to some business, bring some friends back with me, and that will be the end of it."
"Let me go with you," Marsh said, "on this business of yours. I ain't saying I don't believe you, but it'd all be easier to credit if I could see one of these, you know, with my own eyes."
Joshua looked at him. Marsh glanced into his eyes briefly, but something in there seemed to reach out and touch him, and suddenly, without meaning, he had to look away. Joshua folded up the river chart.
"I do not think it would be wise," he said.
"But I will think about it. Excuse me. I have things to attend to." He rose and left the table. Marsh watched him go, unsure of what had just passed between them. Finally, he muttered, "Damn him anyhow," and turned his attention to his ham steak. Hours later, Abner Marsh had visitors. He was in his cabin trying to sleep. The soft knock on his door woke him as if it had been a thunderclap, and Marsh could feel the pounding of his heart. For some reason, he was scared. The cabin was pitch dark.
"Who is it?" he called out.
"Damn you!"
"Just Toby, Captain,"
came the soft, whispered reply. Marsh's fear suddenly melted away and seemed silly. Toby Lanyard was the gentlest old soul ever set foot on a steamboat, and one of the meekest as well. Marsh called out,
"Coming,"
and lit a lamp by his bedside before going to open the door. Two men stood outside. Toby was about 60, bald but for a fringe of iron-gray hair around his black skull, his face worn and wrinkled and black as a pair of old comfortable boots. With him was a younger Negro, a short, stout brown man in an expensive suit. In the dim light, it was a moment before Marsh recognized him as Jebediah Freeman, the barber he had hired up in Louisville.
"Captain," said Toby, "we wants to talk to you private if we can."
Marsh waved them in.
"What's this about, Toby?" he asked, closing the door. "We's kind of spokesman," said the cook. "You knowed me a long time, Captain. You knows I wouldn't lie to you."
"Of course I do," said Marsh.
"I wouldn't run off, neither. You done give me my freedom and all, just for cooking for you. But some of them other niggers, the stokers and such, they won't listen to Jeb and me here about what a fine man you is. They scared, and likely to run off. The boy at supper tonight, he heard you and Captain York are talking about going down to this Cypress place, and now all the niggers is talking."
"Why," Marsh said, "you never been down here before, neither of you. What's Cypress landing to you?"
"Nothing at all," Jeb said, "but some of these other niggers heard of it. There's stories about this place, Captain. Bad stories. All the niggers run off from that place because of things went on there. Terrible things, Captain. Just terrible."
"We come to ask you not to go on down there, Captain," Toby said. "You know I never asked you for nothing before. No cook and no barber are going to tell me where to take my steamboat,"
Abner Marsh said sternly. But then he looked at Toby's face and softened.
"Ain't nothing going to happen," he promised. "But if you two want to wait here in New Orleans, you go ahead. Won't need no cooking nor no barbering on a short run like this."
Toby looked grateful, but said,
"The stokers, though,
them I need.
They ain't going to stay, Captain, I tell you.
I reckon Harry Mike will have a thing or two to say about that."
Jeb shook his head.
"Them niggers is scared of Harry Mike, sure enough. But they's more scared of this place you're fixing to take us. They'll run off, sure as anything."
Marsh swore. "Damn fools," he
said. Well, we can't get up steam without no stoker. It was Joshua wanted to make this trip, not me. Give me a few moments to dress, boys, and we'll hunt up Captain York and speak to him about this. The two black men exchanged looks, but said nothing. Joshua York was not alone. When Marsh strode up to the door of the captain's cabin, he heard his partner's voice, loud and rhythmic, from within. Marsh hesitated, then groaned when he realized that Joshua was reading poetry, aloud even. He hammered at the door with his stick, and York broke off his reading and told them to come in. Joshua sat calmly with a book in his lap, a long, pale finger marking his place, a glass of wine on the table beside him. Valerie was in the other chair. She looked up at Marsh and quickly away. She had been avoiding him since that night on the Texas, and Marsh found it easy to ignore her. "Tell him, Toby," he said. Toby seemed to have far more difficulty finding words than he had with Marsh, but he finally got it all out. When he was done, he stood with his eyes downcast, twisting his old battered hat in his hands. Joshua York wore a grim look. "What do these men fear?" he asked in a polite, cold tone.
"Getting hurt, sir."
"Give them my word that I will protect them." Toby shook his head.
"Captain York, no disrespect, but them niggers is afraid of you, too. Especially now that you want us to go down there."
"They think you's one of them," Jeb put in. "You and your friends, luring us down there to the others like it were. And stories say those folks there don't come out by day, and you's the same, Captain, just the same. Of course, me and Toby knows better, but not them others."
"Tell them we'll double their wages for the time on the bayou," Marsh said. Toby didn't look up, but shook his head.
"They don't care about no money. They's going to run off."
Abner Marsh swore.
"Joshua, if neither money nor Harry Mike can get them to do it, they ain't a-going to do it. We'll have to discharge them all and get us some new stokers and rousters and such. But that'll take us some time."
Valerie leaned forward and laid her hand on Joshua York's arm.
"Please, Joshua," she said quietly. "Listen to them. This is a sign. We were not meant to go. Take us back to St. Louis. You promised to show me St. Louis."
"I shall," Joshua said. "But not until my business is concluded." He frowned at Toby and Jeb. "I can reach Cypress Landing overland easily enough," he said. "No doubt that would be the quickest and simplest way to accomplish my goals. But that does not satisfy me, gentlemen. Either this is my steamer or it is not. Either I am captain here or I am not. I will not have my crew distrusting me. I will not have my men afraid of me." He set the book of poems on the table with an audible thump, clearly frustrated.
"Have I done anything to harm you, Toby?" Joshua demanded. "Have I mistreated any of your people? Have I done anything at all to earn this suspicion?"
"No, sir," Toby said softly.
"No, you say. Yet they will desert me despite that?"
"Yes, sir, Captain. Afraid so," Toby said.
Joshua York took on a hard, determined look.
"What if I proved I was not what they think me?"
His eyes went from Toby to Jeb and back again.
"If they saw me in daylight, would they trust me?"
"No,"
Valerie said. She looked aghast.
"Joshua, you can't..."
"I can," he said, "and will." "Well, Toby?"
The cook raised his head, saw York's eyes, and nodded slowly.
"Well, maybe. If they seed you wasn't..."
Joshua studied the two black men for a long time.
"Very well," he said at last. "I will dine with you tomorrow afternoon, then. Have a place set for me."
"Well, I'll be damned," said Abner Marsh.
Chapter 13. Aboard the steamer Fever Dream, New Orleans, August 1857. Joshua wore his white suit down to dinner, and Toby outdid himself. Word had gotten around, of course, and virtually the entire crew of the Fever Dream was on hand. The waiters, neat as pins in their smart white jackets, glided to and fro, bearing Toby's feast out from the kitchen on big steaming platters and fine china bowls.
There was turtle soup and lobster salad, stuffed crabs and larded sweetbreads, oyster pie and mutton chops, terrapin, pan-fried chicken, turnips and stuffed peppers, roast beef and breaded veal cutlets, Irish potatoes and green corn and carrots and artichokes and snap beans, a profusion of rolls and breads, wine and spirits from the bar and fresh milk in from the city, plates of new churned butter, and for dessert plum pudding and lemon pie and floating islands and sponge cake with chocolate sauce. Abner Marsh had never had a better meal in his life. "Damn," he said to York, "I wish you came to dinner more often, so we'd eat like this most every day." Joshua barely touched his food, however. In the bright light of day, he seemed a different person, shrunken somehow, less imposing. His fair skin took on an unhealthy pallor beneath the skylights, and Marsh thought there was a chalky grayish tinge to it. York's movements seemed lethargic, and occasionally jerky, with none of that grace and power that was normally so much a part of him. But the biggest difference was in his eyes. Beneath the shade of the wide-brimmed white hat he wore, his eyes appeared tired, infinitely tired. The pupils were shrunken down to tiny black pinpricks, and the gray around them was pale and faded, without the intensity Marsh had seen in them so often. But he was there, and that seemed to make all the difference in the world. He had come out of his cabin in broad daylight and walked across the open decks and down the stairs and set himself down to dine before God, the crew, and everyone. Whatever stories and fears his night hours had given birth to seemed damn silly now, as the good light of day washed down on Joshua York and his fine white suit. York was quiet through most of the meal, though he gave diffident answers whenever someone asked a question of him, and infrequently tossed a comment of his own into the tabletop. When the desserts were served, he pushed his plate aside and put down his knife wearily. "Ask Toby to come out," he said. The cook came forward from the kitchen, spotted with flour and cooking oil. "Didn't you like the food, Captain York?" he asked. "You hardly ate none of it." "It was fine, Toby. I'm afraid I don't have much appetite at this time of day. I am here, however. I trust I've proved something." "Yes, sir," said Toby. "Won't be no trouble now." "Excellent," York said. When Toby had returned to his kitchen, York turned to Marsh. "I've decided to lay over another day," he said. "We'll steam out of here tomorrow at nightfall, not tonight." "Well, sure, Joshua," Marsh said. "Pass me down another piece of that pie, will you?" York smiled and passed it to him. "Captain, tonight would be better than tomorrow," said Dan Albright, who was cleaning his teeth with a bone toothpick. "I smell a storm coming up." "Tomorrow," York said. Albright shrugged. "Toby and Jeb can stay behind. In fact," York continued, "I want to take only the bare complement necessary to man the boat. Any passengers who boarded early are to be put ashore for a few days until our return. We won't be taking on any freight, so the roustabouts can be given a few days off as well. We'll take only one watch with us. Can that be done?" "I reckon," Marsh said. He glanced down the long table. The officers were all looking at Joshua curiously. "Tomorrow at nightfall, then," York said. "Excuse me. I must rest." He stood up and for a brief instant seemed unsteady on his feet. Marsh got up from the table hurriedly, but York waved him away. "I'm fine," he said. "I'll be retiring to my cabin now. See that I am not disturbed until we are ready to leave New Orleans." "Won't you be down for supper tonight?" Marsh asked. "No," said York. His eyes moved up and down the cabin. "I do think I prefer it by night," he said. "Lord Byron was right. Day is far too gaudy." "Eh?" Marsh said. "Don't you remember," York said, "the poem I recited to you at the boatyards in New Albany? It fits the fever dream so well. She walks in beauty, like the night," said Jeffers, adjusting his spectacles. Abner Marsh looked at him, flabbergasted. Jeffers was a demon for chess and ciphering, and even went to plays, but Marsh had never heard him recite no poetry before. "You know Byron," Joshua said, delighted. For an instant, he looked almost like his own self. "I do," Jeffers admitted. One eyebrow arched as he regarded York. "Captain, are you suggesting that our days are spent in goodness here on the fever dream?" He smiled. "Why, that'll sure come as news to Harry Mike and Mr. Fram here." Harry Mike guffawed, while Fram protested. "Hey, now, three wives don't mean I ain't good. Why, most every one of them would vouch for me." "What the hell you talking about?" Abner Marsh put in. Most of the officers and crew looked as confused as he was. Joshua played with an elusive smile. "Mr. Jeffers is reminding me of the final stanza of Byron's poem," he said. He recited. "And on that cheek and o'er that brow, so soft, so calm, yet eloquent, the smiles that win, the tints that glow, but tell of days in goodness spent, a mind at peace with all below, a heart whose love is innocent." "Are we innocent, Captain?" Jeffers asked. "No one is entirely innocent," Joshua York replied. "But the poem speaks to me nonetheless, Mr. Jeffers. The night is beautiful, and we can hope to find peace and nobility in its dark splendor as well. Too many men fear the dark unreasoningly." "Perhaps," said Jeffers. "Sometimes it ought to be feared, though." "No," said Joshua York. And with that he left them, breaking off the verbal fencing match with Jeffers abruptly. As soon as he was gone, others began to leave the table to attend to their duties, but Jonathan Jeffers remained in his place, lost in thought, staring off across the cabin. Marsh sat down to finish his pie. "Mr. Jeffers," he said, "I don't know what's going on along this river. Damn poems. What good did all that fancy talk ever do anyhow? If this Byron had something to say, why didn't he just out and say it in plain, simple language? Answer me that." Jeffers looked over at him, blinking. "Sorry, Captain," he said. "I was trying to remember something. What was it you said?" Marsh swallowed a forkful of pie, washed it down with some coffee, and repeated his question. "Well, Captain," Jeffers said with a wry smile, "the main thing is that poetry is pretty. The way the words fit together, the rhythms, the pictures they paint. Poems are pleasant when said aloud. The rhymes, the inner music, just the way they sound." He sipped some coffee. "It's hard to explain if you don't feel it. But it's sort of like a steamer, Captain." "Ain't never seen no poem pretty as a steamer," said Marsh gruffly. Jeffers grinned. "Captain, why does the Northern Light have that big picture of the Aurora on her wheelhouse? She don't need it. The paddles would turn just as smartly without it. Why is our pilot house and so many others all fancied up with curlicues and carvings and trim? Why is every steamer worth her name full of fine wood and carpets and oil paintings and jigsaw carpentry? Why do our chimneys have flowered tops? The smoke would come out just as easy if they were plain." Marsh burped and frowned. "You could make steamers plain and simple," Jeffers concluded. "But the way they are, that makes them finer to look at, to ride on. It's the same with poetry, Captain. A poet could maybe say something straight out, sure enough, but when he puts it in rhyme and meter, it becomes grander." "Well, maybe," Marsh said dubiously. "I bet I could find a poem even you would like," Jeffers said. "Byron wrote one, in fact. The Destruction of Sennacherib, called. Where is that?" "It's a who, not a where," Jeffers corrected. "A poem about a war, Captain. There's a marvelous rhythm to it. It gallops along as lively as buffalo gals." He stood up and straightened his coat. "Come with me. I'll show you."
Marsh finished the dregs of his coffee, pushed off from the table, and followed Jonathan Jeffers aft to the Fever Dreams library. He collapsed gratefully in a big overstuffed armchair, while the head clerk searched up and down the bookcases that filled the room and rose clear to the high ceiling. "There it is," Jeffers said at last, pulling down a fair-sized volume. "I knew we had to have a book of Byron's poems somewhere." He leafed through the pages. A few had never been cut, and he sliced them apart with his fingernail, until he found what he was looking for. Then he struck a pose and read, "The Destruction of Sennacherib." The poem did have quite a rhythm to it, Marsh had to admit, especially with Jeffers reciting it. It wasn't no Buffalo Gals, though. Still, he kind of liked it. "Not bad," he admitted when Jeffers had finished. "Didn't care for the end, though. Damn Bible thumpers got to drag the Lord in most everywhere." Jeffers laughed. "Lord Byron was no Bible thumper, I can assure you," he said. "He was immoral, in fact, or so it was said." He took on a thoughtful look and began turning pages again. "What are you looking for now?" "The poem I was trying to recollect at the table," Jeffers said. "Byron wrote another poem about night, quite at odds with... Ah, here it is." He glanced up and down the page, nodded. "Listen to this, Captain. The title is Darkness." He commenced to recite. "I had a dream, which was not all a dream. The bright sun was extinguished, and the stars did wander darkling in the eternal space, rayless and pathless, and the icy earth swung blind and blackening in the moonless air. Morn came and went, and came, and brought no day, and men forgot their passions and the dread of this their desolation, and all hearts were chilled into a selfish prayer for light." The clerk's voice had taken on a hollow, sinister tone as he read. The poem went on, longer than any of the others. Marsh soon lost track of the words, but they touched him nonetheless, and cast a chill that was somehow frightening over the room. Phrases and bits of lines lingered in his mind. The poem was full of terror, of vain prayer and despair, of madness and great funeral pyres, of war and famine and men like beasts. "A meal was brought with blood, and each sat sullenly apart, gorging himself in gloom. No love was left. All earth was but one thought, and that was death, immediate and inglorious. And the pang of famine fed upon all entrails. Men died, and their bones were tombless as their flesh. The meager by the meager were devoured." And Jeffers read on, evil dancing after evil, until at last he concluded, "They slept on the abyss without a surge. The waves were dead. The tides were in their grave. The moon, their mistress, had expired before. The winds were withered in the stagnant air, and the clouds perished. Darkness had no need of aid from them. She was the universe." He closed the book. "Ravings," Marsh said. "He sounds like a man taken with fever." Jonathan Jeffers smiled wanly. "The Lord didn't even put in an appearance." He sighed. "Byron was of two minds about darkness, it seems to me. There's precious little innocence in that poem. I wonder if Captain York is familiar with it." "Of course he is," Marsh said, hoisting himself out of his chair. "Give that here." He extended his hand. Jeffers handed him the book. "Taking an interest in poetry, Captain?" "Never you mind about that," Marsh replied, slipping the book into his pocket. "Ain't there any business to attend to in your office?" "Certainly," said Jeffers. He took his leave. Abner Marsh stood in the library for 3 or 4 minutes, feeling mighty odd. The poem had had a very unsettling effect on him. Maybe there was something to this poetry business after all, he thought. He resolved to look into the book at his leisure and figure it out for himself. Marsh had his own errands to run, however, and they kept him busy through most of the afternoon and early evening. Afterward, he forgot all about the book in his pocket. Carl Fram was going into New Orleans to sup at the St. Charles, and Marsh decided to join him. It was almost midnight when they returned to the fever dream. Undressing up in his cabin, Marsh came upon the book again. He put it carefully on his bedside table, donned his nightshirt, and settled down to read a bit by candlelight. Darkness seemed even more sinister by night. In the dim loneliness of his little steamer cabin, although the words on the page didn't have quite the cold menace that Jeffers had given them, still they disquieted him. He turned pages and read Sennacherib, and She Walks in Beauty, and some other poems, but his thoughts kept wandering into darkness. Despite the heat of the night, Abner Marsh had goose flesh creeping up his arms. In the front of the book there was a picture of Byron. Marsh studied it. He looked pretty enough, dark and sensual like a Creole. It was easy to see why the women went for him so, even if he was supposed to be a gimp. Of course, he was a nobleman, too. It said so right beneath his picture. George Gordon, Lord Byron, 1788 to 1824. Abner Marsh studied Byron's face for a time and found himself envying the poet's features. Beauty was never something he had experienced from within. If he dreamed of grand, gorgeous steamers, perhaps it was because he so conspicuously lacked beauty himself. With his bulk, his warts, his flat, squashed nose, Marsh had never had to worry over much about women, either. When he'd been younger, rafting and flatboating down the river, and even after he'd worked a spell on steamers, Marsh had frequented places in Natchez under the Hill and New Orleans, where a riverman could find a night's fun for a reasonable price. And later, when Fever River Packets was going strong, there were some women in Galena and Dubuque and St. Paul who would have married him for the asking. Good, stout, hard-faced widow women who knew the worth of a sound, strong man like him with all those steamboats. But they had lost interest quick enough after his misfortune, and anyway, they had never been what he'd wanted. When Abner Marsh let himself think of such things, which wasn't often, he dreamed of women like the dark-eyed Creole ladies and dusky free quadroons of New Orleans, lithe and graceful and proud as his steamers. Marsh snorted and blew out his candle. He tried to sleep, but his dreams were flushed and haunted. Words echoed dimly and frighteningly in the darkened alleys of his mind. Morn came and went, and came, and brought no day. Gorging himself in gloom, no love was left. Men forgot their passions in the dread of this their desolation. A meal was brought, with blood. An astounding man. Abner Marsh sat bolt upright in his bed, wide awake, listening to the thumping of his heart. Damn, he muttered. He found a match, lit his bedside candle, and opened the book of poems to the page with Byron's picture. Damn, he repeated. Marsh dressed quickly. He yearned for company, something fierce, for Harry Mike's muscles and black iron billet, or Jonathan Jeffers and his sword cane. But this was between him and Joshua alone, and he had given his word not to talk to no one. He splashed some water on his face, took up his hickory stick, and went out onto the deck, wishing he had a preacher on board, or even a cross. The book of poems was in his pocket. Far down the landing, another steamer was building steam and loading. Marsh could hear her roustabout singing a slow, melancholy chant as they toted cargo across the planks. At the door to Joshua's cabin, Abner Marsh raised his stick to knock, then hesitated, suddenly full of doubts. Joshua had given orders not to be disturbed. Joshua was going to be almighty displeased by what Marsh had to say. The whole thing was tomfoolery. That poem had just plagued him with bad dreams, or maybe it was something he ate. Still... He was still standing there, frowning in thought, his stick upraised, when the cabin door swung silently open. Inside was as dark as the belly of a cow. Moon and stars cast some small light across the doorframe, but beyond was hot velvet blackness. Several paces back from the door, a shadowy figure stood. The moon touched bare feet, and the vague shape of the man was dimly felt. "Come in, Abner," came the voice from the darkness. Joshua spoke in a raspy whisper.
Abner Marsh stepped forward across the threshold. The shadow moved, and suddenly the door was closed. Marsh heard it lock. It was utterly dark. He couldn't see a thing. A powerful hand gripped him tightly by the arm and drew him forward. Then he was pushed backward, and he was afraid for an instant until he felt the chair beneath him. A rustle of motion in the darkness. Marsh looked around blindly, trying to make sense out of the black. "I didn't knock," he heard himself say. "No," came Joshua's reply. "I heard you approach. I have been expecting you, Abner."
"He said you would come,"
came another voice from a different part of the darkness. A woman's voice, soft, bitter. "Valerie." "You," said Marsh in astonishment. He had not expected that. He was confused, angry, uncertain. And Valerie's presence made it even more difficult. "What are you doing here?" Marsh demanded.
"I might ask the same of you,"
her soft voice answered.
"I am here because Joshua needs me, Captain Marsh, to help him. And that is more than you have done for all your words. You and your kind, with all your suspicion, all your pious..."
"Enough, Valerie," Joshua said curtly. "Abner, I do not know why you have come tonight, but I knew you would come sooner or later. I might have done better to take a dullard as a partner, a man who would take orders without questions. You are too shrewd, perhaps, for your own good and mine. I knew it was only a matter of time until you saw through the tale I spun for you at Natchez. I've seen you watching us. I know about your little tests." He gave a rough, forced chuckle. "Holy water, indeed."
"Oh, you knew then," Marsh said.
"Yes. Damn that boy. Don't be too hard on him. He had little to do with it, Abner, though I did notice him staring at me all during supper." Joshua's laugh was a strained, terrible sound. "No, it was the water itself that told me. A glass of clear, clean water shows up in front of me a few days after our talk, and what am I to think? All the time we've been on the river, we've been getting water full of mud and sediment. I could have started a garden with the river mud I've left at the bottom of my glass." He made a dry, clacking sound of amusement. "Or even filled my coffin." Abner Marsh ignored the last. "Stir it up and drink it down with the water," he said. "Make a river man of you." He paused. "Or maybe just a man," he added.
"Ah," said Joshua.
"So we come to the point." He said nothing more for a long time, and the cabin seemed suffocating, thick with darkness and silence. When Joshua finally spoke, his tone was chilled and serious. "Did you bring a cross with you, Abner? Or a stake?" "I brung this," Marsh said. He pulled out the book of poems and tossed it through the air to where he judged Joshua was sitting. He heard a motion, a snap, as the spinning book was snatched from the air. Pages rustled. "Byron," Joshua said, bemused. Abner Marsh couldn't have seen his fingers wriggling an inch in front of his face, so thoroughly was the cabin shuttered and curtained. But Joshua could not only see well enough to catch the book, but to read it as well. Marsh felt goosebumps rise on him again, despite the heat.
"Why Byron?" asked Joshua.
"You puzzle me. Another test? A cross? Questions? Those I might have anticipated, not Byron."
"Joshua," said Marsh, "how old are you?"
Silence.
"I'm a fair judge of age," Marsh said. "You're a hard one, with your white hair and all. Still, from the looks of you, your face, your hands, I'd say 30, 35 at the most. That book there says he died 33 years ago. And you say you knew him."
Joshua sighed.
"Yes." He sounded rueful. "A stupid mistake. I was so taken by the sight of this steamer that I forgot myself. Afterward, I thought it would not matter. You knew nothing of Byron. I was sure you would forget."
"I ain't always quick, but I don't forget."
Marsh took a hard, reassuring grip on his stick and leaned forward. Joshua, I want us to talk. Get the woman out of here. Valerie laughed icily in the darkness. She seemed closer now, though Marsh had not heard her move. He is a bold fool, she said. Valerie will stay, Abner, Joshua said bluntly. She can be trusted to hear anything you might care to say to me. She is as I am. Marsh felt cold and very alone. Like you are, he echoed heavily. Well then, what are you? Judge for yourself, Joshua replied. A match flared suddenly, startlingly, in the black cabin. Oh my God, Marsh croaked. The brief, small flame threw harsh light on Joshua's features. His lips were swollen and cracked. Burned, blackened skin pulled tight across his forehead and cheeks. Blisters, swollen with water and pus, bulged beneath his chin and clustered on the raw red hand that cupped the match. His gray eyes gaped, whitened and rheumy from hollow pits. Joshua York smiled grimly, and Marsh heard the seared flesh crackle and tear. Pale white fluid ran slowly down one cheek from a fissure freshly torn open. A piece of skin fell away, revealing raw pink flesh beneath. Then the match went out, and darkness was a blessing. His partner, you said, Valerie said accusingly. You would help him, you said. This is the help you gave him. You and your crew with your suspicions and your threats. He might have died for your sake. He is the Pale King, and you are nothing. But he did this to himself to win your worthless loyalty. Are you satisfied, Captain Marsh? It seems not, since you are here. What the hell happened to you? Marsh asked, ignoring Valerie. I was in the light of your gaudy day for less than 2 hours, Joshua replied. And now Marsh understood his pained whispering. I was aware of the risk. I have done it before when it was necessary. 4 hours might have killed me. 6 hours, most certainly. But 2 hours or less, most of it spent out of direct sunlight, I knew my limits. The burns look worse than they are. The pain is bearable, and this shall pass quickly. By tomorrow at this time, no one will ever know anything had touched me. Already my flesh healed itself. The blisters burst, the dead skin sloughs off. You saw for yourself. Abner Marsh shut his eyes, opened them. It made no difference. The darkness was as full either way, and he could still see the pale blue afterimage of the match hanging before him, and the awful specter of Joshua's ravaged face. Then it don't matter about the holy water and the mirrors, he said. It don't matter. You can't go out by day, not really. What you said, those goddamn vampires of yours, they're real. Only you lied to me. You lied to me, Joshua. You ain't no vampire hunter. You're one of them. You and her and all the rest of them. You're vampires, your goddamn selves. Marsh held his walking stick out in front of him, an ineffective hickory sword warding off things he could not see. His throat felt raw and dry. He heard Valerie laugh lightly and move closer. Lower your voice, Abner, Joshua said calmly, and spare me your indignation. Yes, I lied to you. At our very first meeting I warned you that if you pressed me for answers you would get lies. You forced the lies from me. I only regret that they were not better lies. My partner, Abner Marsh said angrily. Hell, I can't believe it even now. A killer, or worse than a killer. What have you been doing all these nights? Going out and finding somebody alone, drinking blood, ripping them apart, and then moving on. Yes, sir, now I see. A different town most every night. You're safe that way. By the time the folks ashore find what you've done, you're gone off somewhere else. And not running, neither. Just loafing along in grand style in a fancy steamer, with your own cabin and everything. No wonder you wanted yourself a steamboat so much, Mr. Captain York. God damn you to hell.
Be silent, York snapped, with such force in his voice that Marsh abruptly closed his mouth. Lower that stick before you break something, waving it around. Lower it, I say. Marsh dropped the walking stick to the carpet. Good, said Joshua. He is like all the rest, Joshua, Valerie said. He does not understand. He has nothing for you but fear and hate. We can't let him leave here alive. Perhaps, Joshua said reluctantly. I think there is more to him than that. But perhaps I'm wrong. What of it, Abner? Be careful what you say. Speak as if your life hung on every word. But Abner Marsh was too angry for thought. The fear that had filled him had given way to a fever of rage. He had been lied to, made a part of this, played for a big, ugly fool. No man treated Abner Marsh like that, no matter if he wasn't a man at all. York had turned his fever dream, his lady, into some kind of floating nightmare. I've been on this river a long time, Marsh said. Don't you try to scare me none. When I was on my first steamer, I seen a friend of mine get his guts cut out in a St. Joe saloon. I grabbed the scoundrel that did it, took the knife off him, and broke his damn back for him. I was at Bad Axe, too, and down in Bleeding, Kansas, so no goddamn bloodsucker is going to bluff me. You want to come for me? You come right on. I'm twice your weight, and you're burned up all to hell. I'll twist your damn head off. Maybe I ought to do that anyhow for what you done. Silence. Then, astonishingly, Joshua York laughed, long and loud. Ah, Abner, he said when he had quieted again. You are a steamboatman, half dreamer and half braggart, and all fool. You sit there blind when you know I can see perfectly well by the light leaking in through the shutters and drapes and beneath the door. You sit there fat and slow, knowing my strength, my quickness. You ought to know how silently I can move. There was a pause, a creak, and suddenly York's voice came from across the cabin. Like this. Another silence. And this. Behind him. And this. He was back where he had started. Marsh, who had turned his head every which way to follow the voice, felt dizzy. I could bleed you to death with 100 soft touches you'd hardly feel. I could creep up on you in the darkness and rip out your throat before you realized I'd stopped talking. And still, despite everything, you sit there looking in the wrong direction with your beard stuck out, blustering and threatening. Joshua sighed. You have spirit, Abner Marsh. Poor judgment, but lots of spirit. If you're fixing to try to kill me, come on and get it done, Marsh said. I'm ready. Maybe I never outrun the eclipse, but I done most everything else I had a mind to. I'd rather be rotten in one of those fancy New Orleans tombs than running a steamer for a pack of vampires. Once I asked you if you were a superstitious man or a religious one, Joshua said. You denied it. Yet now I hear you talking about vampires like some ignorant immigrant. What are you saying? You're the one told me. Yes, yes. Coffins full of dirt, soulless creatures that don't show up in mirrors, things that can't cross running water, creatures who can turn into wolves and bats and mists, yet cringe before a clove of garlic. You're too intelligent a man to believe such rubbish, Abner. Shrug off your fears and your angers for a moment and think. That brought Abner Marsh up short. The mocking bite of Joshua's tone made it all sound mighty silly, in fact. Maybe York did get all burned up by a little daylight, but that didn't change the fact that he drank holy water and wore silver and showed up in mirrors. You telling me you ain't no vampire now, or what? Marsh said, lost. There are no such things as vampires, Joshua said patiently. They are like those river stories Carl Fram tells so well, the treasure of the Drennan White, the phantom steamer of Rakuchi. The pilot, who was so conscientious he got up to stand his watch even after he died. Stories, Abner. Idle amusements, not to be taken seriously by a grown man. Some of them stories is part true, Marsh protested feebly. I mean, I know lots of pilots who claim they seen the lights of the Phantom when they went down the Rikuchi cutoff, and even heard her landsman cussing and swearing. And a Drennan White. Well, I don't believe in no curses, but she went down just like Mr. Fram tells it, and them other boats that came to raise her went down too. As for that dead pilot, hell, I knew him. He was a sleepwalker, is what it was, and he piloted the steamer while he was dead asleep. Only the story got exaggerated a mite going up and down the river. You've made my point for me, Abner. If you insist on the word, then yes, vampires are real. But the stories about us have gotten exaggerated a mite as well. Your sleepwalker became a corpse in a few years of telling stories about him. Think of what he'll be in a century or two. What are you, then, if you ain't no vampire? I have no easy word for what I am, Joshua said. In English, your kind might call me vampire, werewolf, witch, warlock, sorcerer, demon, ghoul. Other languages offer other names. Nosferatu, Odorotan, Upir, Lugaru. All names given by your people to such poor things as I. I do not like those names. I am none of them. Yet I have nothing to offer in their stead. We have no name for ourselves. Your own language, Marsh said. We have no language. We use human languages, human names. Such has always been our way. We are not human, yet neither are we vampires. We are another race. When we call ourselves anything, it is usually one of your words and one of your languages to which we have given a secret meaning. We are the people of the night, the people of the blood, or simply the people. And us? Marsh demanded. If you're the people, what are we? Joshua York hesitated briefly, and Valerie spoke up. The people of the day, she said quickly. No, Joshua said. That is my term. It is not one my people use frequently. Valerie, the time for lies is past. Tell Abner the truth. He will not like it, she said. Joshua, the risk. Nonetheless, Joshua said, Valerie, tell him. Leaden silence for a moment, and then softly Valerie said, The cattle. That's what we call you, Captain. The cattle. Abner Marsh frowned and clenched a big, rough fist. Abner, Joshua said, you wanted the truth. I have been giving you a great deal of thought of late. After Natchez, I feared I might have to arrange an accident for you. We dare not risk exposure, and you are a threat to us. Simon and Catherine both urged me to have you killed. Those of my newer companions, whom I have taken into my confidence, like Valerie and Jean Ardent, tended to concur. Yet, though my people and I would undoubtedly be safer with you dead, I held back. I am sick of death, sick of fear, endlessly weary of the mistrust between our races. I wondered if perhaps we might try working together instead. But I was never certain that you could be trusted. Until that night in Donaldsonville, that is. That night when Valerie tried to get you to turn the fever dream. You proved stronger than I had any right to expect when you resisted her. And more loyal as well. Then and there, I decided. You would live. And if you came to me again, I would tell you the truth, all of it. The good and the bad. Will you listen? Do I got much choice? Marsh asked. No, admitted Joshua York. Valerie sighed. Joshua, I plead with you to reconsider. He's one of them, however much you like him. He will not understand. They'll come up here with sharpened stakes. You know they will. I hope not, Joshua said. Then to Marsh, he said, She is afraid, Abner. This is a new thing I propose to do, and new things are always dangerous. Hear me out and do not judge me, and perhaps we can have a true partnership between us. I have never told the truth to one of you before. To one of the cattle, Marsh grumbled. Well, I never listened to no vampire before neither, so we're even. Go on. This here bull is listening.
Chapter 14. Of Days Dark and Distant. Listen then, Abner. But first hear my conditions. I want no interruptions. I want no outraged outbursts, no questions, no judgments from you. Not until I am finished. Much of what I have to say you will find grim and terrible, I warn you. But if you let me take you from the beginning to the end, then perhaps you will understand. You have called me a killer, a vampire. And, in a sense, I am. But you have killed as well, by your own admission. You believe your acts justified by the circumstances. So do I. If not justified, then at least mitigated. Hear all I have to say before you condemn me and my kind. Let me begin with myself, my own life, and tell you the rest as I learned it. You asked my age. I am young, Abner, in the first flush of adult life by the standards of my race. I was born in provincial France in the year 1785. I never knew my mother for reasons I shall reveal later. My father was a minor noble. That is, he granted himself a title as he moved through French society. He had been in France several generations, so he enjoyed a certain status, though he claimed to be of Eastern European origin. He had wealth, a small amount of land. He accounted for his longevity by a ruse in the 1760s, whereby he posed as his own son and eventually succeeded himself. So you see, I am some 72 years old, and I did indeed enjoy the good fortune of meeting Lord Byron. That was some time later, however. My father was as I am. So were two of our servants. Two who were not truly servants, but companions. The three adults of my race taught me languages, manners, much of the world, and cautions. I slept by day, went out only by night, learned to fear the dawn as children of your race, having been burned, learned to fear fire. I was different from others, I was told, superior and apart, a lord. I must not talk of those differences, though, lest the cattle fear me and kill me. I must pretend that my hours were simply a matter of preference. I must learn and observe the forms of Catholicism, even take communion at special midnight masses in our private chapel. I must... Well, I will not go on. You must realize, Abner, I was only a child. I might have learned more in time, might have begun to comprehend the why and the wherefore of those around me, and the life we led, had things continued. I would then have been another person. In 1789, however, the fires of the Revolution changed my life irrevocably. When the terror came, we were taken. For all his cautions, his chapels, and his mirrors, my father had aroused suspicion by his nocturnal habits, his solitude, his mysterious wealth. Our servants, our human servants, denounced him as a warlock, a Satanist, a disciple of the Marquis de Sade, and he called himself an aristocrat as well, the blackest sin of all. His two companions, being seen only as servants themselves, managed to slip away, but my father and I were taken. Young as I was, I have vivid memories of the cell in which we were imprisoned. It was cold and damp, all rough stone with a great door of iron so thick and heavily barred that even my father's great strength was no use against it. The cell stank of urine, and we slept without blankets, in filthy straw scattered over the floor. There was one window, but it was far above us, slanting through a solid stone wall at least 10 feet thick. It was very small, and the outside was heavily barred. We were actually below the ground, I think, in a sort of cellar. Very little light filtered down to us, but of course that was a blessing in disguise. When we were alone, my father told me what I must do. He could not even get to the window, the gap in the stone being so narrow. But I could. I was still small, and I had the strength to deal with the bars. He ordered me to leave him. He gave me other advice as well, to wear rags and draw no attention to myself,
to hide by day and pilfer food by night, never to tell anyone how I was different, to find myself a cross and wear it. I did not understand half of what he said, and soon forgot much of it, but I promised to obey. He told me to leave France, and to seek out the servants who had fled. I was not to try to avenge him, he said. I would have vengeance enough in time, for all these people would die, and I would live. Then he said something I have never forgotten. They cannot help themselves. The red thirst is on this nation, and only blood will sate it. It is the bane of us all. I asked him what the red thirst was. You will know it soon enough, he told me. It cannot be mistaken. Then he bid me go. I squeezed up the narrow aperture to the window. The bars were old and rusted through. Since it was impossible to get to them, no one had given thought to their replacement. They broke away in my hands. I never saw my father again. But later, after the restoration that followed Napoleon, I made inquiries after him. My disappearance had sealed his fate. He was clearly a sorcerer, as well as an aristocrat. He was tried, convicted. He lost his head to a provincial guillotine. Afterward, they burnt his body because of the charge of sorcery. But I knew none of this then. I fled the prison and the province and wandered to Paris, where survival was easy in those days, so chaotic was the situation. By day, I took refuge in cellars. The darker, the better. By night I came forth and stole food, meat chiefly. I had little taste for vegetables or fruits. I became a proficient thief. I was fast, silent, and terribly strong. My nails seemed sharper and harder each day. I could claw through wood when I had a mind to. No one noticed me or questioned me. I spoke good, cultured French, fair English, and a smattering of low German. In Paris, I picked up the gutter tongue as well. I searched for our vanished servants, the only others of my race I had ever known, but I had no clue how to find them, and my efforts came to nothing. So I grew up among your people, the cattle, the people of the day. I was clever and observant. Much as I looked like those around me, I soon realized how truly different I was, and better, as I had been told. Stronger, quicker, and, I believed, longer-lived as well. Daylight was my only weakness. I kept my secret well. The life I led in Paris, however, was mean and degraded and boring. I wanted more. I began to steal money as well as food. I found someone to teach me how to read, and thereafter I stole books whenever I could. Once or twice I was almost caught. But I always got away. I could melt into shadows, scale walls in the winking of an eye, move as quietly as a cat. Perhaps those who pursued me thought I changed into a mist. It must have seemed that way at times. When the Napoleonic Wars began, I was careful to avoid the army, since I knew they would require me to expose myself to daylight, but I followed behind them in their campaigns. I traveled through Europe in that fashion, saw much burning and killing, and where the emperor went, there was loot for me. In Austria, in 1805, I saw my great chance. On the road by night, I chanced upon a wealthy Viennese merchant, fleeing before the French armies. He had all his money with him, converted to gold and silver, a fabulous sum. I stalked him to the inn where he spent the night, and when I was sure he was asleep, broke in to make my fortune. He was not asleep, however. The war had made him afraid. He was waiting for me, and he was armed. He pulled a pistol from beneath his blankets and shot me. The shock and pain overwhelmed me. The blow drove me to the floor. It had caught me in the stomach square, and I bled profusely. But then, suddenly, the flow began to ebb, and the pain lessened. I got up. I must have been a terrible sight, pale-faced and covered with blood, and a strange feeling came over me, one I had never felt before. The moon was coming in through the window, and the merchant was screaming, and before I knew quite what I was doing, I was on him. I wanted to silence him, to clamp my hand over his mouth, but something took hold of me. My hands went to him, my nails. They are very sharp, very hard. I tore open his throat. He choked on his own blood. I stood there trembling, watching the black blood spurt out from him, his body thrashing on the bed in the pale moonlight. He was dying. I had seen people die before in Paris in the war. This was different. I had killed him. A great passion seemed to fill me, and I felt desire. I had read often of desire in the books I stole, of lust and the carnal urges to which man is heir. I had never felt any of it. I had looked on naked women, on men, on couples locked in sexual congress, and none of it had touched me. I could not comprehend all this nonsense I read of uncontrollable passions, lust like fire. But now I knew them. The blood flowing, this fat, rich man dying in my hands, the noises he made, his feet beating on the bed. It all excited some animal deep within me. The blood drenched my hands. It was so dark and hot. It steamed as it came from his throat. So I leaned forward and tasted it. The taste made me mad, feverish. Suddenly I had plunged my face into his neck, ripping with my teeth, sucking up the blood, tearing, swallowing. He stopped thrashing. I fed. And then the door opened, and there were men with knives and rifles. I looked up, startled. How I must have terrified them. Before they could act, I was through the window and gone into the night. I had the presence of mind to grab the money belt as I went. It had only a fraction of the man's fortune in it, but it was enough. I ran long and far that night, and passed the next day in the root cellar of a farmhouse that had been burned and abandoned. I was 20 years old, among the people of the night a child still, but now coming into adulthood. When I woke that night in the root cellar, covered with dried blood and clutching the money belt to me, I remembered my father's words. I knew what the red thirst was at last. And only blood will sate it, he had said. I was sated. I felt stronger and healthier than ever in my life. Yet I was sick and horrified as well. I had grown up among your people, you see, and I thought as you did. I was no animal, no monster. There and then I resolved to change the way I lived, so such a thing might never happen again. I washed, stole clothes, the finest I could find. I moved west, away from the fighting, then north. I took rooms and inns by day. I had coaches to travel from town to town each night. Finally, with difficulty due to the war, I made my way to England. I took a new name, determined to make myself a gentleman. I had the money. I could learn the rest. My journeys had taken me about a month. My third night in London, I felt strange, sick. I had never been ill in my life. The next night was worse. The night after, finally, I knew the feeling for what it was. The red thirst was on me. I screamed and raged. I ordered up a fine meal, a great rich red slab of meat, I thought, would slake the yearning. I ate it and willed myself to calm. It was no use. Within the hour, I was out on the streets. I found an alley, waited. A young woman was the first to pass. Part of me admired her beauty. It burned in me like a flame. Another part simply hungered. I almost tore her head off, but at least it was over quickly. Afterward, I wept. For months, I despaired. From my readings, I knew what I must be. I had learned those words. For 20 years I had thought myself superior. Now I found I was something unnatural, a beast, a soulless monster. I could not decide whether I was a vampire or a werewolf, which puzzled me. Neither I nor my father had the power to turn into anything. But my red thirst came on me monthly, in what seemed a lunar cycle. Although it did not always coincide with the full moon, that was a characteristic of the werewolf, I read. I read a great deal on those subjects at that time, trying to understand myself. Like the werewolf of legend, I often tore out the throat, and I did eat some small amount of flesh, especially if the thirst was on me badly. And when the thirst was not on me, I seemed a decent enough person, which also fit the werewolf legends. On the other hand, silver had no power over me, nor wolfbane. I did not change my shape or grow hair. Like the vampire, I could only walk by night, and it seemed to me that it was the blood I truly craved, not flesh. But I slept in beds, not coffins, and had crossed running water hundreds of times easily. I was certainly not dead, and religious objects bothered me not at all. Once, to be sure, I spirited away the body of a victim, wondering if it would rise as a wolf or a vampire. It stayed a corpse. After a while it began to smell, and I buried it. You can imagine my terror. I was not human, but neither was I one of these legendary creatures. I decided my books were useless to me. I was on my own. Month after month, the red thirst came upon me. Those nights were filled with an awful exultation, Abner. In taking life, I lived as never before. But there was always an afterward. And then I was filled with loathing for the thing I had become. I slayed the young, the innocent, the beautiful, they above all. They seemed to have an inner light that inflamed the thirst as old and sick people could not. And yet at other times I loved the selfsame qualities I was drawn to kill. Desperately I tried to change myself. My will, so strong normally, was nothing when the red thirst was on me. I turned to religion with hope. When I felt the first tendrils of the fever in me, I sought a church and confessed everything to the priest who answered my knock. He did not believe me, but he agreed to sit and pray with me. I wore a cross, knelt at the altar, prayed fervently, with the candles and statues all around me, safe in the house of God, one of his ministers by my side. Within 3 hours I turned on him and killed him right there in the church. Caused a small sensation when the body was found the next day. I tried reason next. If religion had no answers, then what drove me could not be supernatural. I slaughtered animals instead of humans. I stole human blood from a doctor's office. I broke into a mortician's office where I knew a fresh corpse had been taken. Each of these helped. They quieted